Seeing none, all in favor of the A5 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? That amendment is adopted. And members, I have an amendment, which is the A6 amendment. That should be in your packets. And this does a couple of things. The first thing it does is it, you know, we have provisions for the a rate of increase of the COLA, and there was distinctions between the bill, I think, 7 and 6 in Representative Haas's bill. This one does 5% increase in the COLA. I think that's a finance issue, and so what this would do is put in a blank percentage right now, and then we'll leave that to the Finance Committee to determine what's appropriate and what's affordable. So that's the first part of the amendment. The middle part of the amendment, honestly, must be a technical change, Mr. Chun.
Mr. Chair and members, the middle part of the amendment picks up some of the language from the governor's COLA increase bill, which I think had some updated statutory cross-references.
Right, members, if you remember going through the kind of comparison chart, there was a provision in the governor's bill that applied the COLA to a number of additional providers, and so we're picking up that language from the governor's proposal. That's kind of the middle of page 1 through line 2.6. So that's coming out of the governor's budget proposal. And line 2.7 through 2.12 is actually language from a bill that I'm hearing that we'll be hearing later today. And all this is saying is that when the COLA goes into effect, it's going to get to the nursing homes right away. I understand there was a little bit of a delay the last time we did this, so that the COLA took a couple of months to get to the nursing home. So what this is saying is that the commissioner and the counties shall act to get the COLA to the nursing homes as quickly as possible. Okay, and I think the agency had to talk about that, but there's questions, members? Representative Finstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you could give me your thoughts a little bit. Representative Fritz's bill, I believe she did an oral amendment to put the 5 and 5 in there. And just from the pure policy, because I know you don't like to deal with finance in this committee, just from the pure policy perspective, those of us that don't sit on the Finance Committee, I mean, this is our one shot to really send a bill on with the message of we're pretty serious about putting some dollars into this area. So a blank appropriation, in my mind, is my chance to say, well, Finance Committee, fill it in with whatever you want. So I would, and I want to give your thoughts before I would make any sort of motion or anything, but just get your feel a little bit more, if you could give me some details about why you want to get rid of the 5 and 5. I think that's our one shot as a policy committee to send a message to the Finance Committee that this is a priority. So make me feel comfortable with what you're doing in this amendment.
I think that's fair. There's also a proposal to do a 7 and a 6 that's been on the table. I think part of it is to say, as a policy committee, to be honest, I don't know if we're going to get to 5 and 5. You know, there's also that piece of it, and I don't know what kind of expectations we want to create. So, you know, without knowing the finances, it's hard to talk about that. I think you raise a good point and say, as a policy, this is where we want to put our priorities. I'll leave that to the membership of the committee, and we can, I really don't, everybody's kind of free to vote as they wish on that. So if there wants to be an amendment, I think Representative Anderson wanted to...
Okay. Mr. Chair, just looking through the bill, trying to correlate your insertion of 5, or taking the 5 and 5 out, and I see some have the 5 in and some have blanks in them, so I'm just...
We made it, Representative Anderson, we made an amendment last time to put the 5 in where those blanks are.
Okay, so this is an old bill that hasn't been updated?
Because we didn't pass it.
Okay.
Yes.
But so some has 5 in and some doesn't have.
No, currently they all have 5 in there.
No, this one doesn't.
The copies don't, but we have already amended in this committee in our last meeting to put 5 in those places. So officially there is a 5 there, even though the bill doesn't say that, because we couldn't re-engross it because we didn't pass it on to anywhere. Okay. Further discussion, why don't we keep on Representative Finstead's point here. So any further discussion about what we want to do with regard to the Representative Fritz?
Representative Thiessen, Chairman Thiessen, and members, I have, I want the 5 to stay, and I think 5 is a good number for us moving forward, and I agree, Representative Finstead, that if we take it out, we start over from zero. And I you know, five is a good place, and I just want to speak in favor of keeping the five and five in.
Further discussion or an amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could Mr. Chun help me with, should I just move to amend your amendment by deleting line 1.2 to 1.5? Would that be the best one, or?
Mr. Chair, Rep. Spinstead, yes, that would work.
That's my amendment then, Mr. Chair.
Okay, you know, I'll incorporate that as a friendly amendment.
Thank you.
All right, further discussion of the amendment. Representative Broad.
Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering if you can just help me better understand line 2.10 and just the language, everything behind regardless. I just want to maybe understand that a little bit better in terms of its impact.
Well, and maybe Mr. Litz can come down. I think that there is I think that they deal with rape kind of on a schedule at the county level, and this is just to say that that preempts that, so that the increase goes into effect. But Mr. Litz?
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you. For the record, my name is John Litz. I'm with Care Providers of Minnesota and appearing here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. Mr. Chairman, the explanation you gave was slightly inaccurate, I
think,
so far as the origin of the language. We had heard from our senior housing providers, our elderly waiver providers, that in some instances the rate increase that was due to take effect on 10-106 did not take effect on that date, that the increase with respect to an individual client would come along later than that date, maybe a month later or 2 months later or 3 months later. This is anecdotal from our members in the field. There may be a variety of explanations, but one of the explanations we heard through our members was that some counties believed that they were supposed to pass along the increase when an individual client's service reauthorization date came up. These individuals are sort of eligible for the program on an annual basis and then reauthorized. And so the intention of the language was to clarify that the counties should be passing this along on October 1st or whatever the first day of the rate year is.
Right. So this is related to waivers, not the... Yes.
Mr.
Thank
Chairman,
you.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. Does that answer your question?
It does,
okay.
Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the language, and
yeah.
I support it.
Representative Laughlin.
Mr. Chairman, and on that point, I understand the intention is to make sure that the money gets there, but I think the practical, and I don't have any problem with the client service authorization, but I think the provisions dealing with the terms of a contract, et cetera, we need to, before it gets acted on in finance, get some county input in. Counties typically deal with a wide range of vendors across all kinds of waiver programs and county property tax funded programs. And they typically have one contract with that vendor rather than having 10 different contracts, depending on what the funding source is for that particular client. And so I think that the way we've handled it in the past is that they start those contracts as of the first of the year, and I think we can implement your intention, which is that the money gets out to the providers without nullifying other contract provisions that might be related to county taxpayer dollars and some of those just practical implementations on particularly the home care area where there is, they may want to put increases in related that aren't negotiated by state legislative committees.
Baron, did the department have any comment on this? I had heard a discussion. Is there anybody here that, no? Okay. I will work on that. That's not the intent. I think we'll try to get some language that works. The intent is to get the money there as quickly as possible. So, any further discussion? All right. To the A6 amendment as amended, I'm not sure if that's what I have to say or not, but I guess as amended, yes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? All right. The A6 is adopted. A further discussion to the House File 721 members. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Fritz renews her motion that 721 be recommended to pass and re-referred to finance. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Pass as amended. Okay. All opposed say no. The motion is adopted, and the bill passes as amended. Thank you. All right. I think we're going to go a little bit off the schedule to accommodate some folks. We're going to bring up Representative Fritz, House File 712. I think there's some people that are in from farther away, so we're going to do that. And Representative Fritz will move that House File 712 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the finance. Which one has to go then? Representative Fritz, your bill.
Thank you, Chairman Thiessen and members. I'm Representative Patty Fritz from District 26B. I've been a long-time nurse in the long-term care industry. When I started, they were nursing homes. That was over 40 years ago. It is my pleasure to bring House File 712 before the committee today. Mr. Chair and members, the bill before you, House File 712, requires that all health care facilities in the state...
Representative Fritz, I'm sorry. Should we just move your DE1 first to get in the order that you want to... Okay. DE2, I'm sorry. Representative Fritz moves the DE2, which is an author's amendment to get the bill in the form she wants it. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? I'm assuming you're going to explain the bill as amended?
Yes.
Is that okay? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. The House File 712, again, requires that all health care facilities in the state of Minnesota adopt a written safe patient handling policy by January 1st, 2008, to achieve the goal of minimizing manual lifting of patients by nurses and other direct patient care workers. By utilizing safe patient handling equipment by January 1st, 2011. I will briefly comment on some of the common myths associated with patient handling, as well as address some of the Minnesota facts of injury rates and costs associated with those types of work injuries. But I will leave most of that data and personal stories to the testifiers I have with me here today, and I appreciate you moving us up on the agenda, Ms. Representative Thiessen and members. A couple of these folks are from, I believe, Duluth, and they may be staying tonight anyway, so I hope. Some of the myths I wanted to talk about briefly are that training and education are effective in reducing injuries. 35 years of research dispute the classes in good body mechanics as training and training in lifting prevent work-related injuries. Good body mechanics don't work to prevent injury because the amount lifted exceeds the parameters for safe lifting, which is 32 pounds per patient handling. And in my career, I've lifted 250 pounds with a transfer belt in and out of bed onto the toilet and in and off the wheelchairs. Many of my nurses and direct care nursing assistants are doing that still today. Another myth, mechanical lifts and safe patient handling equipment are not affordable. My mother bought one for $2,700 when my father was became ill and lived in at home in Northfield. They range from $1,500 to $7,000, and I think that in my facility we spent $4,700 on the two that we have. The life expectancy of equipment is 10 years. I believe ours is over 20 years old. We try to take good care of our equipment. And the return on investment is 3 to 4 years. Patients won't like them or refuse to have them used. When patients are manually repositioned, moved, they suffer anxiety, pain, and injury. When we use our hands, oftentimes lifting our patients to and from the bathtub, the bed, they slip and fall. In a mechanical device such as, and they're called the Hoyer lift, and I wish we had one here, and we will have one here in the Capitol on Nurses Day. So we'll give you all a lift. And I've been in them myself. I've been, as I've demonstrated over my years, I've been the person they've lifted. And the PAL lift, which lifts you up into a standing position.
Initial fear, it is usually short-term, the initial fear, and use of equipment is well received by patients and families. At the onset of taking a machine into the bedside to the patient, we instruct and educate the patient as we go and just promote a safer lift for that patient. And in because we don't have a lot of time in the snowstorm, I want to stop here, and I'm going to turn it over to a couple of testifiers that I have here from and let them give you their testimony, and then if you have any questions, further questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Okay. My name is Elizabeth Shogren, and I am a registered nurse employed by the Minnesota Nurses Association for the last 23 years. I'm a staff specialist in occupational health and safety. In the 2004 Minnesota report from the Valley Department of Labor and Industry on workplace safety, there was data that showed that of the most frequent OSHA recordable injuries, that data that was printed, they listed the top 14 occupations where injuries occur. On that list, nursing assistants are number 2, RNs are number 7, and LPNs are number 12. Without getting into the detail of the report, essentially it says that healthcare workers have higher rates of injuries and more severe injuries than most other workers in the state of Minnesota. When we brought this bill forward, we want to make it perfectly clear that the association understands that employers did not intentionally hurt their employees. They relied on a standard industry practice that we now know, due to scientific research, was not effective in preventing injury. We're not here to place blame, but rather to focus on what we need in the future to ensure the safe working conditions of our members and other healthcare workers in an industry that faces an acute shortage of workers within the next decade. M&A has worked extensively with the Allina Corporation and with the Hospital Association to bring a new program called Safe Patient Handling to Minnesota. We have seen significant success with employers such as Allina, Mayo, Fairview, Bemidji, and some nursing homes. Now, this is not an all-inclusive list, so if you're not on it, don't worry about it, so that you know who you are. We commend those who are changing, but we need the rest of the employers to follow their lead. Safe Patient Handling is simply a program based on science, the scientific work of Dr. Bill Maris, and it was initially implemented in this country in the Veterans Administration in Tampa, Florida. When the VA started using the new approach to lift, move, and transport patients, two things happened very quickly. The frequency and severity of worker injury declined, and the patient injuries related to falls and others such as skin tears, dislocated shoulders, fractures, and pressure ulcers also declined. Although there may have been some initial anxiety, as Representative Chris indicated, there's not much that we do in healthcare that doesn't cause some initial anxiety with people. If you think about your own experiences, in a very short time, the patients not only accepted, but they expressed preference in the use of equipment in their care. The success of the Tampa VA has been replicated in numerous facilities, including the long-term care industry across this country. The Safe Patient Handling Program, because it was developed by the Veterans Administration, is public domain. It's free. It walks an employer through the steps necessary to start and fully implement the Safe Patient Handling Program. We have asked for grant money in this bill to assist the employers with startup costs associated with implementing this change. It isn't a common occurrence for unions to ask for financial assistance from employers. Usually we're trying to get some of that money. But we believe that it's in the best interest of the patients, the employers, and the workers, and will expedite the changes that we need in order to reduce injuries. In conclusion, I'd like to say the continued use of manual patient handling is unsafe for healthcare workers, for patients, and it contributes to the increased cost of care in an environment where all of us are questioning the rising cost of health care. Thank you for hearing the concerns of the registered nurses in Minnesota, and I'm available for questions at the appropriate time.
Chairman Thiessen and members, I have Stacey Lundquist from the Minnesota Nurses Association next as a testifier.
Thanks for coming.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for holding this hearing today. My name is Stacy Lundquist, and I'm a registered nurse, but I will never again work as a registered nurse. In 2004, at the age of 50, and after working full-time for approximately 20 years, I was diagnosed with a very serious back injury that ended my nursing career. It also ended any opportunity for employment anywhere. I was employed at a hospital in northern Minnesota in the day surgery and post-anesthesia care unit, where the nurses were often required to transport post-surgical patients to other units to receive further care. Many of these patients were transported on a stretcher or a hospital bed in which the weight being transported could easily exceed 300 to 800 pounds respectively. If we were moving a heavy patient, and many patients are becoming very heavy, or one requiring equipment such as oxygen tanks, monitors, and traction, those weights would increase. In most situations, it was necessary to push the stretcher or bed several hundred feet, which included multiple stops, starts, and turns. The floors were often carpeted, which dramatically increased the resistance and made the task even more difficult. For many years, I had asked our employer for a device that would help move the stretchers and beds, one similar to what we see in a grocery store parking lot, where the employees use the tool to mechanically move the grocery carts back into the stores. I asked for the equipment because it was extremely difficult to push those beds, and I knew that either myself or one of my coworkers was going to be seriously injured. During the last week on the job, I needed to transport a 300-pound orthopedic patient in a bed with multiple other pieces of equipment over from my unit to the floor. This was well over 800 pounds. I tried to get assistance, but I could only find one nursing assistant to help me. She and I pushed that bed through the halls, onto and off the elevator, and over carpeted floors. It took all we could do to move the bed. Suddenly, I experienced severe pain, and I knew that something very bad, had happened to me. When my work was done, I went home, and I tried to relieve the pain, but nothing seemed to help. I went to work the next day, and I was unable to complete my shift. I returned a second day, and that day I was no longer able to get out of a chair, could barely make it to my car. I went home, and I have never returned to work again. To his credit, once my employer saw what had happened to me, he took immediate action and invested in a significant amount of equipment for the entire facility. I applaud his actions for my colleague's sake. Unfortunately, it is too late for me. I've had 4 surgeries over the last 2.5 years. I suffer from severe chronic pain, which can only be controlled with medication. I can walk only short distances with a cane and must use a wheelchair when I leave my home. The pain is so intense that some days I tell my husband, I think I would rather be a paraplegic. I have lost my career. My injury fundamentally changed every part of my life. I can't walk, I can't drive, I can't shop, I can't bike, I can't go on vacation, I can't pitch a tent, hike in the woods, all things I enjoyed doing. I can't sleep or rest without medication, and I can't even do that very well. I couldn't pick up my first grandchild. I believe all of that could have been prevented if I had had one single piece of equipment. The pain I endure every day may never end, and the rest of my life will never be what it could have been. The data is so clear. Every day nurses go to work, we risk injury because we don't have the necessary equipment to protect ourselves and our patients. With the current nursing shortage and aging workforce, Employers cannot afford to delay correcting this situation. I made a long and painful journey to get here today to see you because I wanted you to see what happens when nurses and other healthcare workers don't have appropriate equipment. I know that my degree of injury is not typical, but it is not unusual. There are other nurses like me. I am here to ask for help. Not for me, it's too late for me, but I'm here for every other person. People who take care of people just like you and your family when you all need help. And I thank you again for holding this hearing today. And I'll answer any questions you have.
Thank you for sharing your story too. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate your testimony. As some of you know, I worked with a Medicare demonstration project in long-term care and have some familiarity with the facilities, and I admire and respect what you're trying to do with this bill. My concern, I think, deals more with things like the definition of safe patient handling being exclusively to equipment. When you're talking about 800 pounds, you better have equipment helping you. I agree completely, and I've noticed that many hospitals and nursing facilities are now moving to power-assisted beds, for example, that might have helped with that situation. But, you know, there's nothing in here about safe lifting techniques for people to actually do people-to-people transfers at lower weight levels when you're not dealing with extremely heavy situations. I understand when you're talking about weights that people should not be lifting, person-to-person, that equipment ought to be involved. But this bill seems to focus exclusively on the use of lifting equipment, and I wonder if it wouldn't be stronger if we also included something about safe lifting techniques at lower weight levels. I wonder if you can comment on that.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I can, and I'm never sure how to answer this question. The work of Dr. Bill Maris, it took him 7 years to get approval from the research committee to even do the testing, and the testing he did was with what's called an exoskeleton. It's a series of monitors that go down the spinal cord. And finally, he was able to get approval when they agreed they wouldn't use anyone that weighed more than 110 pounds, and that would be a rarity in the healthcare industry. With that, even at those weights of 110 pounds, even the simplest transfers, when you were rolling someone side to side, if you were helping them get from the bed to the chair, a lateral transfer from a cart to a bed, any of the types of moves that we do repeatedly every day in the healthcare industry produce compressive force to the spine that exceeded the body's ability to tolerate. That compressive force is the generator of the cumulative trauma injury that we see, and it causes microfractures in the end plates of the spinal vertebra that over time interfere with the ability of the body to supply nutrition to the disc, and it causes the disc to disintegrate, and that causes compression on the nerve. We don't have pain receptors, very many in the back, and so by the time we have that degree of injury, it's very severe. So the sad truth is that good body mechanics and lifting techniques just don't work. We've got 30 years of data that show they don't work, and they don't work because the weights that we lift repetitively in our workplaces exceed the body's ability to tolerate that type of a thing. I'd be very happy to spend any amount of time you think is appropriate with you to go over all the scientific data. Good body mechanics and safe lifting techniques is a theory that didn't work, and it was a theory that was based on a single employer asking a group of men to lift a 50-pound box with handles from the floor to waist height, and they subjectively rated their level of comfort. There was never any evidence, and clearly now there's evidence to show that it just can't work. It was a comfort issue more than that, and dealt with more muscle pain than spinal injury. So I'd like to include it, but it would be hard for me to do that because I know it doesn't work.
Representative Gallo.
Mr. Chair, testifiers, with all due respect, from my area of work, body mechanics can help an awful lot. Bending knees when lifting as opposed to bending back can help. It may not prevent all injuries, and I defer to your scientific studies and so forth, but to suggest that proper body mechanics would not help, I think, is probably overstating the need for an exclusive focus on equipment.
Mr. Chair, I agree that in normal everyday activities, bending your knees when you're lifting is probably helpful. The danger in relying on techniques is people have a false sense of security that this is going to protect them, and we know it won't protect them. So I'm not saying never use them. I'm saying as a work practice, it's just not an appropriate way to lift people.
Representative Liebling, yes.
Thank you. To this point, Mr. Chair, thank you. In the bill, on Section 4, lines 3.21 and 3.22, it says grants may also be used for the training of staff on safe patient handling and the use of safe patient handling equipment. Maybe that would speak to Representative Gottwald's concern.
Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, if it does, if that's the intent of that language, then yes, it would address my concern. If the author of the bill would share with me that that's the case, then I guess I would feel better about it.
Representative Thiessen, Representative Gottwald, that is the intention of that piece of the bill. And in the hospitals and nursing homes and clinics, there are committees, safety committees, and this is reviewed and used, and we're tested on it routinely in the healthcare facilities that we are using good body mechanics. And we'll continue to do that. And this bill, that piece of the bill will beef it up.
Further questions for the two testifiers are Mr. Austin, is that correct? Would you like to present your testimony?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joseph J. Austin. I'm the Division Administrator of Employee Safety and Development for St. Louis County. For the past 18 months, I've been involved with implementing a safe patient handling program at Chris Jensen, our 205-bed long-term care facility. So I'm here to testify basically as a person who has been involved implementing the very program that this bill is intended to push forward. You've heard testimony from the others that have talked about the actual risk that's out there. As a safety professional, I am here to testify that risk is real to our healthcare providers. At Chris Jensen, our healthcare facility, working as an aide, in any 1 year prior to our program, an aide had a 50% chance statistically of being injured on the job in any 1 year pre-program. The majority of these injuries and our most severe or OSHA recordables occurred while our employees were transferring residents, that is, moving our residents from a bed to a wheelchair or wheelchair to a commode. To address this issue, we implemented a safe patient handling program that's similar to that described in the bill before you. I'm not going to get into a whole lot of details, but we bought all new beds for our facility that are they're low-high beds, and they move up and down at a very quick rate so that our aides will actually use them. They're called fast electric beds. We purchased the mobile lifts that people are talking about, two different types, and slings for use in transferring and ambulating our residents. And we trained our employees on how to use the equipment. So what did we achieve? We've talked about results that can be achieved. I'm going to talk to you about real results that we have achieved in the past 12 months. Right now we're on the 18th month of our program. During the first 12 months or year of the program, our facility experienced greater than 75% reduction in transfer-related injuries. So that's a pretty easy number to just, you know, think about and say, well, 75%. But the reality of that is more than 10 people that do not have a debilitating back injury because of our program in the last year. Now, I have a back problem that I didn't develop from healthcare, and I know exactly what it's like. It's a life-changing event. It's something that you deal with for the rest of your life. So the reality is I am 100% certain from looking at the statistics free program and comparing them to post program. But there is a minimum of 10 people at our facility in the first year that do not have a similar injury that would have had we not done anything. Opponents of the bill before you may cite cost as a deterrent to safe patient handling. But based on our data, our program has demonstrated a 1 to 2 year payback for safe patient handling in the healthcare facility. And given a little more time, I can give you exact detail on what that is. As a safety professional and a person who's been intimately involved with implementation of safe patient handling, I'm here to testify that safe patient handling can be done cost effectively and the results are real. I have seen the impact of safe patient handling program can have on people's lives. And in my opinion, a properly implemented program represents the single most impressive intervention strategy I have ever witnessed in my 10 plus years as a safety and risk management professional. This bill represents an opportunity to positively impact the lives of thousands of healthcare providers and patients across the state. As with any new law or mandate, we must be cautious as the devil is in the details. Long-term care facilities are strapped financially, and for that reason, we must proceed with caution and create a realistic, team-oriented, based approach to the solution. But the reality is this. Healthcare providers and their patients are being injured. They are being injured during resident handling activities, and if we do nothing, more will be injured today, literally today. There is a cost-effective solution available to address this problem, and we have demonstrated that it works. That solution is safe patient handling. Are there any questions?
President Brock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering, in the plan that you've put forward for safe patient handling, I'm wondering, I was just thinking about these machines and how scary they might be to some of the folks in your facilities. You know, when somebody wheels something in an environment that you're already either uncomfortable in or concerned about, or just there's been a lot of changes, which might be the reason you're there. But do you have any allowances for a resident or somebody who just doesn't want those machines in their room, or what do you do in your plan in that case?
Ms. Ross.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is kind of what I was getting at when I was talking about the devil is in the details, and that's also something that you were talking about, Representative, and where you were getting at that, you know, proper body mechanics may have a part in this. The reality in implementing one of these programs at a site is that you do have to have some flexibility at the beginning, and that actually the equipment that you use and the techniques that you use, how you address the risk associated with providing care to any one resident is completely dependent on the abilities of that resident. So you really have to tailor your response to the individual resident. Our facility does not have what's called a zero lift policy, which you'll hear thrown around a lot. What our facility has is a policy that says that as an aide, you have to do what it says to do on your assignment sheet. And then on that assignment sheet, it specifies how you deal with each transfer, each toilet, each toileting event, you know, how you deal with that specific resident. Because like you said, there may be behaviors involved. There may be physical limitations. But you really need to focus on each resident one at a time, because it's about providing care to those residents. But at the same time, it's about providing that care as safely as you can to them and you.
Representative Pinsett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you all for making the trip to St. Paul. Question, we're talking about the healthcare industry, and we're talking about an industry that's supposed to take care of our aches and pains and our trials and tribulations. You would think this industry would look inward and say, we have some aches and pains within our own body. Help me better understand this. Isn't this an employee versus employer type situation that could be fixed working within the existing units? Do we need more government here? Is the marketplace just completely not responding to the needs of employees?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't know if I'm the perfect person to answer that question, but I can tell you some things based on my experience. The vendors that we've talked to, and frankly, some of the people that I've talked to, I have offered information, and they really, many healthcare facilities were not very open to it, and I think simply because they were not very educated. Real quick story, I was looking for a specific type of equipment that a certain healthcare facility had, and I was talking to a management person at that facility, and while I had them on the phone, I said, well, if you're letting me come down to take a look at your piece of equipment, I would like to, you know, if you want, I will sit down with you for 20 minutes and show you how, essentially, I think that we're going to save our facility $500,000 this year based on the Safe Patient Handling Program. And I said, I have nothing to sell. I'm a government employee. I will just do that kind of as reciprocity. And they said they're not interested. So.
Thank you, Mr. Austin. And Representative Finstead, we have the Hospital Association here, and I just want to add that the excellent job that the industry is trying to do, and that I have a testifier here from the hospital industry, Sue Stout, and she can address that. And I just want to also say that they are addressing it. In new hospitals, they have in the ceilings, the lifts. So they're leading the way in these new hospitals. But we have old facilities. The facility I worked in is over 100 years old, and we don't have any money. And so, you know, we're trying to make good use of the government funds. I wish we had the money. I think my administrator would buy us the equipment, but we just don't have it. So I would like to turn it over at this time to Ms. Stout to talk about her industry.
Ms. Stout.
They're doing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Susan Stout. I represent the Minnesota Hospital Association. We are supporting this piece of legislation today because hospitals know that the new research that's available indicates that the prevention of injuries related to lifting is no longer an issue of learning to lift properly, but includes the proper use of lifting equipment. Hospitals wish to prevent injuries to their nursing staff, and we want to make our hospitals a safer place to work. Now, to Representative Finstead's question, hospitals have changed a lot through the years. There was a time when most hospitals planned for how to deal with lifting was to hire big, strong male orderlies. I remember those days. And that's how we handled all our lifting. Later on, nursing schools taught proper body mechanics. And I went to nursing school in the 70s, and I was told to lift using my legs. And if I only would do that, then it would prevent injuries. Now we've learned that the use of lifts is an important piece to consider, and we've changed over time. We get new information, and hospitals have to change with that information. It's clear that we have a new best practice model, and the best practice model involves nothing to do with who does the lifting or how they lift with their legs or their arms, but rather how to prevent the need to lift entirely, if at all possible. There are times, and I've heard questions today about patients who don't want to get in the lift, and there are times when patients are fearful of a lift and don't want to use it. There are even times when nurses themselves don't want to go down the hall to get the lift because they think, oh, this is just a light patient, I can just do it, I don't need the lift. Essentially, what's happening here is we need to experience a change in our culture. And culture change comes slowly. And all this bill does, in our opinion, is help move the culture change along. It helps us the safe committees are going to help us to talk more and to do more training, to provide the lists available. It's going to get that material out to the nursing staff and other direct care staff. Over time, we're going to see a safer workplace. Obviously, some data shows it isn't a long time. It's a fairly short period of time. We're committed to doing that. Do we need a piece of legislation necessarily to make this all happen? No, we don't. It will speed it up, however, and speed is important. And that's why we're supporting the legislation today. We believe it's the right thing to do, and we want to do the right thing.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Any questions for this testifier?
We have one or two.
Yes. Yes. Mr. Ulan.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Joel Ulan. I'm from the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, Minnesota chapter. I represent about 9,000 people with multiple sclerosis in Minnesota. Of that number, about 15 to 20% of people with multiple sclerosis have a progressive form of the disease that would often require them to have full-time use of a wheelchair or a scooter or a mobility device of that type. And I think one of the problems that we run into for people with MS in these situations is that when they go to a clinic setting or when they're going in for therapy visits or whatever the case may be, and if they are asked to be transferred out of a chair, out of their wheelchair and into onto the examination table or onto the MRI table or whatever the case may be, this is where we run into some of our problems. We know of several situations where people have had difficulty even getting an MRI because there was not enough staff available to help transfer that person onto the MRI table. We've heard many instances when you consider that for people with MS, two-thirds of people with MS are women, pap smears is also a real difficulty where because people are not able to get onto the examination table. And a lot of times the staff is there's not enough staff available to transfer that person onto the table, or even if the equipment is available, we've heard instances just in the past year or two where the equipment is available, but because the training hasn't always been there, staff are unwilling to use the lift to help that person. And so I think what we're hoping for is that this bill will help essentially provide the carrot to help make this happen rather than kind of using the stick approach mandating that it must happen. But if there's essentially some funding available to help get more equipment in there, help get the training available for the staff to use this, I think that it would be very helpful for people with MS and other disabilities who run into these problems.
Thank you, Ms. Sheila. Any questions for the testifier? Gail Sheridan or Mr. Lips?
You can call me Gail. Mr. Chairman and members, thank you. I'm John Lips again from Care Providers of Minnesota, appearing here today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. First, I just want to say for the record that the author's amendment that you adopted today is a real improvement from the bill that was introduced originally, and I want to thank Ms. Shogren, if she's still here, Representative Fritz, Ms. Mortred, and others for talking with us several times and making changes that are helpful in the bill. But I'm here to say that our members still have concerns about the bill because it represents an unfunded government mandate to our members. And as you've already heard from the testimony earlier this week in committee, Mr. Chairman and members, and indeed from Representative Fritz's own experience of the finances of her building, nursing homes are in dire financial condition. And this policy won't be made in a pure vacuum just here in this room. It will be made and it will be implemented in a context where money is extremely tight. To meet the goals of this bill, nursing homes will have to buy some expensive equipment, and many of them will have to remodel their buildings in some way in order to find a place to store these lifts. There is in nursing homes, there are regulations about how corridors have to look and how they have to be maintained, and the handles have to be available for people to use along the edges of the hallway and so on, so you can't just stash them anywhere in the hallway. And the nursing homes that have lifts, and there are many, I would say every nursing home has some lifts, they're storing them in the director of nurse's office, or they're storing them with the patient's indulgence, or the resident's indulgence in a single room in a nursing home, et cetera. So they've got to find a place to put the lifts, and that might require some expenditure as well. Mr. Chairman, I know you have a long agenda, so I don't want to belabor the point. We've heard testimony, and there are other anecdotes available about the return on investment that occurs if you buy these lifts. But even if there is a gradual return on investment, there needs to be an initial upfront cash outlay from these nursing homes, which is tough for them to do. In the nursing home, there's a number of phrases that our nursing home administrators and others use when they talk with us. One of them is there's no free choices in nursing homes. And anything that you choose to do means you don't do something else. And another phrase that resonates with me is the nursing home is a world of competing joys and sorrows. And there are many, many things that nursing homes would like to do, and they're not able to do all of them at once. So we appreciate the work that's been done on the bill. We will continue to speak to Representative Fritz about the bill as it moves forward. But for the record, members, we just wanted to express our concern about the funding piece of the bill. I should say, by the way, the bill, the advocates have included a funding mechanism, but it doesn't guarantee that all of the affected businesses will receive all of the money they need. There's going to be a limited appropriation to a grant program with a matching requirement that all of the nursing homes and hospitals and medical clinics in Minnesota will be eligible to apply for. Mr. Chairman, I've taken more time than I intended, but I appreciate it.
Thank you for the testimony. Do questions? Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lips, in your opinion, I guess trying to some clarification here, the DE 2 amendment, the way the bill sits today, is this a compromise between all interested parties? Is that the way I understand this? Or do I understand it correctly?
Representative Hamilton, it certainly represents a compromise from where the parties who have an interest in this bill began the conversation. But from our members have some lingering concerns. I don't know exactly what additional amendments or additional funding mechanisms might be feasible and amenable to the advocates for the bill. We just consider that an ongoing conversation at this point.
Thank you. Any further questions for this testifier? Representative Murphy had a question for an earlier, Ms. Shogren, I believe.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Thank you, Ms.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for either Ms. Shogren or Mr. Austin, you both touched on the issue of improved patient safety with regard to this proposal. And I'm wondering if you have data about that or if Mr. Maris's study that you referred to has data about that. Please.
Ms. Shogren.
I know you think I remember a lot of stuff, but I don't remember all of that. There's probably about 50 studies that have been done in the last 3 to 4 years where there's documentation of a significant reduction in patient injury. 50% reduction is the average, and it's generally related to the types of situations the Representative Fritz was talking about where we drop people. It's probably not a nice thing to say, but that's what happens. And they get hurt. I think the VA has some. There is another nursing home administrator, retired administrator named Joe Jolas, that has some very remarkable data, not only about reduction in patient injuries, staff injuries, but also in return on investment and turnover of staff. When they started their program, they had a 72% turnover of staff, and within a year, that was reduced to 5%. Which has been sustained for over 10 years with that. So I don't know if that's helpful, but I can send you guys a bibliography if you really want to read.
Ms. Murphy, or Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I have some experience in transferring patients in my past, working in a nursing home, med-surg hospital, and in an operating room. And the things that I saw most often that happened to people, there were times when patients fell. But IVs were pulled out, skin was torn, people got bruises and abrasions. And then the other things that people experienced were fear. They were afraid, they're afraid of being moved either way, but they were afraid of being moved by other people because they lose a lot of control. And there's a lot of pain that they experience. So I am interested in the bibliography, if you could share it with me. I'm happy to share it with others if you want it. But I think that there's a real interest on my part in the patient safety aspect of this bill. Thank you.
And if you just want to provide that to Jen, we'll get it to all the members. That's right. Thank you. Any further testifiers on this bill? Representative Fritz, do you?
I just wanted to say thank you, and I hope that this was a good education on the lifts and on the need in our facilities, all of our facilities, and I appreciate your attention, and I know that time that we do have other bills. Representative Thiessen, so
Representative Schumper, yes.
Just one quick question. How many lifts would you need in a nursing home, for example, of 50 residents?
Well, I don't have a number on that, and I think Mr. Austin could probably address what he's done, and we're working on the numbers. Dependent upon, you know, patients are individuals, yeah. And they all have individual needs, and that's why we have care plans per individual patient. And then, you know, we'd have to decide from there. In my nursing home, in my floor, I had 62 residents, and I had 1.5 lifts. One was an old one with a lever, And the other one was the brand new one with the battery, and the battery was usually dead because we use it. And so I had, you know, enough. I would like to have one lift per 30 people. And I think I might be a little bit off on my numbers, but maybe he could address what
Mr. Austin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in terms of trying to tailor the, you know, the types of equipment that you have and the amount of the equipment, again, this is, falls into the devil's in the details part of it, but the reality of it is the types of equipment that you buy, how much equipment you buy, is completely dependent upon the types of residents that you have. And like for our facility, we have 5 different wings, and we have different numbers of lifts and different types of lifts on the 5 different wings. As we are moving into our second phase right now of our program, we are starting to install some of the ceiling-mounted lifts, for example. And on one of our wings, we found it to be completely inappropriate to put those in because of the type of cares that we're doing on that wing. Whereas on other wings, we would want to have many of those. But it is completely dependent upon the type of residence that you have. But I should stress that, in my opinion, one of the primary factors that will contribute to the success or failure of one of these programs at a facility is the amount of equipment that you have, and specifically if the application of that equipment is risk-based, okay, that you actually do tailor the program to the risk that you have that's there.
Thank you. Representative Otrumba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know a lot of people end up on workman's comp from working in long-term care facilities. Have you seen any change in your rates or workers that now are not having to go on workman's comp?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's a question that I get very often, and it's kind of a difficult one for me to answer from the county standpoint because we're self-insured, and I don't want to get too technical, but for us, workers' comp is what we call a lagging indicator of success of a program because we are paying for workers' comp claims that are 10 years old. We have a facility that we closed that was 4 years ago, and it is still one of our highest workers' comp payments per month right now. So the correct answer is we will definitely see that. We are seeing it right now. Is it measurable right now? No. But to look at the impact of the program, then what you need to look at is the number of claims that you are having, the number of new claims you are having, and the number of recordable injuries in each category you're trying to control. That's why when I presented our data, I said we've seen a 75% reduction in transfer-related injuries because that is the specific risk that we had identified and we're trying to control with the program. We know that we have way less claims from transfer-related injuries. That's a fact. But are we seeing a reduction in workers' comp costs right now because of it? No. I mean, we can't measure that right now because of the other things that I talked about.
Thank you very much.
Any further questions?
Yes,
sure.
There have been a number of independent studies in facilities where the programs have been implemented that do document and get it and add it to the bibliography, the reduction in work comp claims. But if you just think about how Minnesota's work comp system works, it generally looks at what your claims experience has been, and there's a fairly complicated formula to decide what the premium is going to be. But clearly when your claims go down, that has an impact over time on workers' compensation premiums. And if you're self-insured in the amount of reserve that you're required to maintain. I don't know how fast that catches up, but there's surely documentation elsewhere that work comp claims and premiums have gone down.
Thank you. And that's actually a good segue to renewing the motion that this bill passed, because I think instead of going to finance, we're going to re-refer this to labor and commerce. The commissioner in the bill is actually the commissioner of the labor, and so I think we have to send it there, and they'll also say look at the workers' compensation aspect of it as well. So, any further questions, members? Seeing none, Representative Fritz renews her motion. that the bill, House File 712, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Commerce and Labor as amended. Thank you. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members, and thank you to the testifiers.
Thank you.
And thank you all for coming. And let me just make a quick comment, too. Thanks to everybody who's been involved in this bill. I know there's been a lot of work behind the scenes to try to reach a compromise. So, Representative Fritz, thanks for that, too.
Thank
for
you.
Working with everybody to pull stuff together. So, that's right. And I'd also like to thank Representative Huntley, now that his time period is over, for lending us this committee time, because we do have a lot of work in the next 3 weeks. We have probably over 100 bills to get through. So, thank you, Representative Huntley. I'd like, before we go on, we had some questions, and I should have gotten this earlier, that Representative Shumper asked about last week, or last meeting, about the forecast and how long-term care money didn't get spent and those issues. And I think we have maybe a little bit more of an answer on that issue. We should probably have taken up that when 721 was here, and I forgot. So, Mr. Hoffman?
Mr. Chairman, members.
Are you aware of the question? Generally, or okay.
I think so, Mr.
Okay.
Chairman. George Hoffman, Department of Human Services. You had some data presented to you on what our original forecasts were for nursing facility expenditures in the medical assistance program and what actual expenditures were. And I would like to explain what that was. For fiscal year 04 and fiscal year 05.
And can you speak into the microphone a little bit more, thanks.
For fiscal year 04 and 05, the original estimates were our end of session 03 forecasts. And so those were forecasts that were done in January of 03. On how much we would spend in the biennium ending June 05. And then the third year, fiscal 06, the original estimate was from end of session 05, and it was for fiscal year 06 ending June 06. Now, we didn't spend as much money as we forecasted, but the forecast was 97% accurate. And this is a forecast from 1.5 to 2.5 years out. Now, the variables that affect how much we spend are how many MA patients we have in nursing homes, how many days of care they receive, what the rates are in, what the applicable rates are in the facilities, and how much money the patients contribute out of their own income to the cost of care. And so my basic answer to the question is a forecast which is 97% accurate from 1.5 to 2.5 years out is a very good forecast. Now, one further point is the department, since those are the variables, the department does not have authority to change those variables. We don't control the caseload, and the rates are set by law, and so we don't have authority to say, oh, we're not spending as much as we have available, we'll raise the rates. The legislature has not given us that authority, and in the states that have such authority, I believe the tendency probably is that authority is used to cut the rates rather than to raise the rates, because if the program runs short, then in some states, the administrative agency has that kind of authority.
Does the money cancel to the general fund if it's not spent?
If
in the sense, if the forecast is the forecast is higher than actual expenditures, that money shows up in the forecast as a surplus, I guess, or as money in the general fund?
We update the forecast periodically as we go along, and based on updates to the forecast, the state adjusts its overall forecast of how much money we expect to spend in the programs. And so step by step as we go along, adjustments are made, and it is recognized that we will spend either more or less. What cancels to the general fund if we underspend in the aggregate is what we underspend in the aggregate in all of the general fund programs. So we might underspend on nursing facilities, we might still overspend in the whole of medical assistance, but we might have underspending other areas. And what ends up going back to the general fund is the net of all that and all the programs.
Representative Shumpert, did you want to?
Well, you know, I think everyone has this handout I provided. If you look on the back where it talks about, first of all, it uses the word state appropriations for fiscal year.
State appropriations for fiscal year 204. Did you have a copy of this?
I have seen that.
Okay. And so are you using that synonymously with forecast? Are you using the word forecast synonymous with appropriation?
We get an appropriation at the end of session, at the end of a budget session, like the 03 session. And then in November, we update our forecast, and the state changes its estimate of how much we are going to spend. That forecast can go up or down. We can anticipate spending more or anticipate spending less. Typically, there's a lot of up and down movement across the various programs. If we start anticipating spending more, that increases the responsibility of the general fund. And if we anticipate spending less, then it's anticipated that the difference will fall to the bottom line of the general fund. And we go through this process in a November forecast and a February forecast, each step updating further and further what we expect to happen in the programs. And then sometimes in the session in the even numbered year, sometimes the appropriations are adjusted based on our forecast, and sometimes they are not, and sometimes the appropriations are left to stand until the end of the biennium. And then at the end of the biennium, if there is money left over, then the money left over cancels to the bottom line of the general fund. But this process is anticipated step by step in the forecast process. So we anticipate in successive forecasts that we will spend either more or less out of the appropriations. If we start anticipating that we don't have enough money, then in the even year session, the off year session, then we have to ask the legislature for supplemental appropriations in order to make up the difference. If we anticipate that there will be money left, then of course there is no need for supplemental appropriations.
Mr. Chair,
Representative,
I just wanted to call this to the attention of the members of the committee, and if you look on the reverse side of this handout, you can see $38 million went back to the general fund from what was appropriated, and yet there are, you know, a quarter of the nursing facilities are in crisis. And so, you know, I'm certainly not faulting the department on that. It's just, you know, maybe somehow we have to figure out a way of dealing with that somehow.
No, Representative, thank you, Mr. Hoffman, for coming in and explaining. I think it raises some interesting questions, and, you know, to the extent that we're trying to save some money in healthcare in general this year, if there's a way to maybe recapture that and kind of tie that to expansion of access, I think there's some some budgeting mechanism we may that may be helpful. Representative Huntley?
Just a comment for Mr. Hoffman, Mr. Chair. Anybody that can predict anything within 3% 2 years out is doing a good job.
Thank you for coming down. I appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman.
I would like to take up Representative Walker, the committee report on House File 196, which is a report from the Mental Health Division. Do you want to just briefly cover that? And members, as we've discussed in the past, you know, I really do want to respect the work of this division, which has input from a lot of places. I've gone through the bill, and I think, you know, there's a few areas that kind of have broader health care implications. Not too many, but I'd like to kind of restrict any discussion to that and then try to pass this on to finance. So, Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
To public safety, excuse me.
Yes, thank you. I move the adoption of the committee report.
All in favor of adopting the committee report, the division report, excuse me, say aye just to get us in front of us.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay, we've adopted the report. And then I suppose you need to make a motion to re-refer the bill to public safety?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I do move to re-refer the bill to public safety policy.
As amended?
As amended.
Okay, so it's before us now, members. Representative Walker. You can go to the table if you want, or you can stay there.
You know, I'm real comfortable right here, Mr. Chair. I have lost all energy this week. It's been a long week. House File 196 is Representative Greiling's bill. This is a bill that comes together from a wide variety of different advocates in the community and consumers. It deals with suicide prevention and intervention. It has some provisions in there as it relates to loan forgiveness programs, targeting communities of color. It has some barriers, as eliminating some barriers and dealing with some assessments to really get at a better early screening of individuals. We have dollars in here that was amended with Representative Reinhart with peer specialists. The other thing to note for members, initially this bill was going to travel in multiple bills with a wide variety of individuals carrying those bills and just have the original House File 196 heard in division and laid on the table in division. And we decided after listening to the speaker's staff and sitting down and discussing the aggressive deadlines that we have, the difficulty that these different bills would have, not only getting hearings, but if they had to go through multiple committees, that it would be best served to have House File 196 travel as a whole and try to make it through all the policy committees by deadline. I guess I will stop there, Mr. Chair, and see if there's any questions or comments by members.
And members, are there any questions? Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if it's appropriate to comment on it at this point, but I'm sure a number of other committee members have received a number of emails concerning the Columbia team screen portion of this. And you know, that's kind of the nature of these omnibus bills, is you get everything, and if you object to one part of it, you have to make a decision. Are you going to vote for the whole thing, or are you going to try to amend out a part of it, or what? But a lot of very serious concerns around that piece and about over-screening in general. But
I've gotten some of those emails as well. Just a couple things for the committee to know. This is, as I understand it, really more of an educational screening issue. Maybe Representative Walker can comment on this. And in Representative Dominguez's subcommittee of the Education Committee, they're actually taking up the individual bill that deals with this specific provision. It strikes me that this provision is within the Mental Health Division, but it's not really health policy related. So I'd prefer if we could leave that discussion for where. So, you know, if you want to say that we're just, your vote today is focused on the health provisions of the bill, that's fair enough. Or vote, you know, obviously the way you need to, but that's how I would prefer to handle this issue.
Briefly, Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gottwald, yes. The team screen, I do agree with the chair as it relates to. It's going to have a nice discussion and debate in the education committees. But the other thing to note, many of the emails that we're getting, the math emails, aren't completely accurate in their understanding. It's a voluntary program. The information that individuals have in the community thinks that every household in Minnesota will have to have this, just like that information as it relates to home visiting. This is a voluntarily put out there program, and it's one of those things that it's how do you get, you know, young people early if we have the options of getting them early and getting them the support, the services, and sometimes treatment that they need to have in early start is really important, I believe. But this is going to be debated, and I'm pretty sure we will get a lot more emails between now and then as it travels.
Further questions, members? Seeing none, then Representative Walker will renew her motion that House File 196, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Law, and I guess that's the motion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. The bill will move forward. Thank you. Representative Abler.
Oh, yeah, just while people are still here, I just wanted to announce that we're working on this Vicodin NASPR, or whatever you want to call it, working group to try to get to the bottom of the problem and find best solutions for it. That meeting was supposed to be today at 4. We canceled it yesterday or the day before, anticipating the snow, which is actually came so I looked like I'm smarter. If it would have been a sunny day, I would have felt embarrassed. But it's going to be on Monday at 4, and also next Thursday at 4. We're hoping to have a two-meeting series and
get it resolved.
There you go.
Thanks.
We'll see how that goes.
Yeah, good. All right, Rep, we're going to have House File 908, Representative Liebling. And we're skipping around the agenda, members, because we have people from farther away than closer, so we're trying to accommodate those needs. Representative Liebling will move that House File 908 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Representative Tina Liebling from District 30A in Rochester. And also, Mr. Chair and members, there is an amendment which, if the committee would indulge us, I would like to move the amendment now to put the bill in the shape in which I'd like to discuss it, and then we will be explaining the amendment as we go along. And that is the A1 amendment.
Okay, Representative Liebling moves the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, what you have before you is a bill that deals with quality assurance for folks with disabilities who are in various care settings in the community. As you know, Minnesota has moved from an institutional model of service to a community service model, but our quality assurance system has not kept up with those changes. We need new ways of monitoring dispersed community services and effective methods to discover problems and prevent abuse, neglect, and other violations of persons' rights. We need timely and accurate information about problems in order to improve services and protect the health and well-being of service recipients. Now, members, I have two testifiers here, and I'm going to let them do most of the explanation, but I do want to start out by just reminding members who maybe sat on this committee in the past and telling those of you who did not that this is a very bipartisan issue and was really championed by Fran Bradley in prior years. So this is something that really I think we should find a lot of agreement on. The other piece of this that's important to know is that, as you all know, 50% of our medical assistance costs are paid by the federal government, and that is done through CMS. And CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and CMS has new requirements for states to meet in order to continue to qualify to receive those funds. And so Minnesota really is in the position of having to move to meet new requirements, and that's what this bill is also addressing. So with that, I'm going to turn this over to, to Steve Larson, who's with ARC Minnesota.
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Steve Larson with the ARC of Minnesota, and we're the largest disability organization representing persons with developmental disabilities and their families in the state. And the reason that we're here today is that there's close to $1.5 billion, both state and federal dollars, being spent on services for persons with disabilities on waiver programs. And we had recent presentations by the Department of Human Services about those programs. And as Representative Liebling said in her opening comments, we've moved from an institutional situation from over the past number of years to a community-based system. And the requirements that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid have for these new monitoring of community-based systems they've increased those requirements, and we need to address them in the state of Minnesota. The expansion of the Medicaid-financed home and community-based services and other community service options in Minnesota has dramatically increased the number of settings in which people receive services. This has brought enormous challenges in monitoring service quality and protecting the well-being of persons who receive those services. In recent years, there have been persistent reminders in media and government investigations of the gap between assurances of basic monitoring that the state has made in its HCBS waiver applications and the practical capacities and accomplishments of its quality assurance programs to fulfill those assurances. 2 years ago, we became before this body and had legislation passed to establish a quality assurance panel. That panel has been meeting for the past 2 years to address these issues that have come forth. The result of that panel is a report on quality assurance that will be out within the next week. And we are presenting to you today a draft of the executive summary of that panel that has just been passed out to the committee. And I'm just going to hit a few highlights of that panel report. The quality assurance panel work was guided by the expectations for quality assurance of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services as specified in the CMS quality framework. The quality framework provides states with substantial guidance regarding their responsibilities in managing home and community-based programs, specifically establishes state responsibility for programs of assessment, remediation, and improvement in 7 focus areas, including access, person-centered services, provider capacity, participant safeguards, rights and responsibilities, outcomes and satisfaction, and system performance. The panel's recommendation includes 5 major tasks that we think we need to accomplish. The establishment of a statewide quality commission to provide needed leadership, promote specific guided efforts throughout the state to improve the ability of long-term services and supports to protect the health and safety and to contribute to the quality of life of Minnesotans with disabilities. Regional quality councils to provide leadership, analyze the results of the various quality assurance activities, identify needed program improvements, design and implement program improvement initiatives, an annual independent statewide survey of a sample of service recipients, an outcome-based quality assessment program for service quality monitoring, including both licensed and unlicensed services, based on an outcome-based interviews of sufficient sample of individuals and caregivers supported by an organization to determine organizational performance, and finally, an effective program of incident reporting, investigation, and analysis. The Quality Assurance Panel recognizes that these programs will require time to be fully developed and urges haste in beginning the process without substantial progress. Minnesota's Medicaid home and community-based applications are in jeopardy of rejection, and Minnesota's citizens with disabilities are at risk of receiving services and supports that are of poorer quality than they have the right to expect. We are extremely excited about the possibilities that this report outlines as far as making substantial improvements in both our quality improvement efforts in Minnesota. The bill calls for a phased-in implementation of the Quality Assurance Panel's report so that we can systematically start to begin to address quality issues in our community-based programs. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Mr. Zimmer? Welcome to the committee.
Members, my name is Dan Zimmer, and I'm with the Region 10 Quality Assurance. We work in the southeastern part of Minnesota, but we also provide assistance to other communities. In the last year, last year's in some of their expansion efforts in looking at the quality assurance system that we do. We're in favor of this proposal in that for the last 10 years, we have been working with a regional model quality assurance system in the southeastern part of Minnesota. And we want to continue to work efforts to move forward and to help our state move forward into this statewide effort with regionals. There's other parts of the file that when we approached Representative Liebling that I want to make sure it doesn't get lost in the amendment that just happened today, in that we for the last 10 years have been working with people with developmental disabilities, and we want to make sure that the legislation language can be amended to include all people with disabilities. 10 years ago, we focused our efforts on developmental disabilities, and we were asked to do that, and we feel it's time to move forward and let our voice system be used for anybody with disabilities. Another amendment that we were looking at with the current legislation was to remove our sunset date and make us a permanent organization.
Representative Liebling, do you want to address those?
Yeah, comments? Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to make sure that members understand what's going on here, the original bill is the Region 10 quality assurance piece, and if you look at that, what we're doing in that piece, as Mr. Zimmer was explaining, is to remove the sunset and to expand the category of people that this would apply to. So, and then what we've done with the amendment, which is a substantial amendment, this relates to what Mr. Larson was talking about, and that is the findings from the report. And if members may wonder why we're doing it in this way instead of having a separate bill, and the reason for that is just that the timing, the report is not quite out, but in order to get on with this and make sure that this gets moving in this session, we felt that it was important to put this on as an amendment at this point. The same will be happening with the Senate bill. And also because there's a kind of a question of cost, we need to get the fiscal piece of this going and get our fiscal note, and you'll notice that there are blank appropriations, and we want to get that process started before we go to the Finance Committee.
And Representative Liebling, the amendment won't dictate necessarily that what Region 10 has been following, although I think it's a great model, but it won't necessarily dictate that model will be adopted everywhere else.
Mr. Chair and members, that's correct. Yeah, in fact, maybe I'd let Mr. Zimmer address.
You know, we realize that our efforts in our region work for our region. In 2005, we started approaching other communities within our state, giving them information about what we've been doing and helping them in their processes as well. Even though we consider what we do something that would work for every community in our state, we don't want to mandate that.
Appreciate that. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding Mr. Zimmer, you're in Region 10, but regarding the amendment that was put on it, we're talking about six regional quality councils. Are you guys going to now get incorporated into a different region rather than being Region 10?
Region 10 is was the name comes from the economic regions of the state, and when the panel was looking at the map trying to determine how many regions were to recommend, it boiled down to six. And really, when you look at the active Region 10, it would be the same region. It would just have a different number.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman, my concern is to exactly that point. The bill as originally presented allowed counties to individually or as group form these sort of efforts, and my experience has been that when we let people coalesce around natural partnerships, it actually works better. And the amendment as presented to us says that the commissioner, so it's this top down, the state will draw the map, will establish six throughout the state,
And, you know, we have, I don't know if it's 12 economic development planning regions. One of my pet peeves is that every state agency has at least three different ways of dividing up the state of Minnesota, and you can never get comparable data because we draw the map differently for every little program. And that's okay if it's local determination because there's local partnerships and you have a major service provider that works in these six counties, and so those six counties are together, and it makes sense. But, you know, to add on the seventh one, which works with another whole group of service providers, may not work. And so I'd like to ask Mr. Zimmer if he could imagine his region being as effective, and I'm really impressed with the work that you've done, but could you imagine it as effective if you'd had to deal with, say, four times as many lives and service providers? I'm thinking particularly of those of us who are in the metro area where the tendency is to have one seven-county metro region, and it never really works for anyone in that region on many things. And so I'm just wondering if you, having had the experience of working with this, do you feel that there's sort of a limited size for effectiveness? And could you comment on the self-determination?
Mr. Zimmer.
Mr. Chair and representatives, before I worked in Region 10 Quality Assurance, I worked for providers, and I worked mostly predominantly in St. Paul Ramsey area. Looking at the system that we're using, it boils down to, it starts out one individual at a time, and our voice reviews go one individual at a time. I do think that even a region as big as the Twin Cities would be, it could still develop an effective means to continue to do voice reviews and continue to do our system.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I'd like to address that question too, and I'd like to address the committee members to the A1 Amendment, page 2, and the Regional Quality Councils. And that starts giving you a flavor for what the responsibility of the Regional Quality Councils would be. And it's not surprising to hear Representative Loeffler's questions, because we wrestled with those same comments or issues in the committee. And we did have county members participating on the committee, and to accomplish what's outlined in Subdivision 3, defining regional quality councils, we came to the conclusion that approximately six of those, and we're not tied into whether they're mandatory or voluntary, but we, in order to move this process forward, we thought that this needed to be in effect, and it needed to be in effect across the country, or across the state, with all counties involved eventually, because we're requesting this to be the response to the CMS requirements for their quality framework, and that needs to be a statewide. And the reason we're breaking down into regions is mainly for quality improvement activities, reviewing the data that's out there, identifying trends, addressing those trends through quality improvement and training activities, and we thought that the six regional councils would be the most effective way of doing that. But we're open for discussion on that.
Okay. And Mr. Larson, or any of the testifiers, would the regional councils necessarily mean that smaller units within that region couldn't pursue different types of quality assurance programs? Would there be one for the entire region, or could there be diversity even within the region? I'm not sure. I'm just kind of trying to...
Mr. Chair, as you look at the goals there, the regions would be identifying specific goals, and certainly each county would be responsible for their programs. But one of the things that we talked about with the county representatives, including county representatives from Otter Tail, John Dinsmore, and Alex Bartoli from Hennepin County, is that counties are under great stress for the activities that they need to be responsible for right now. By joining into the regions, we'd be able to maximize their effectiveness by focusing our particular efforts here so that every county would not have to reinvent the wheel on some of their quality initiatives, and so that this would be effective. Probably the model that came closest to helping us identify the regions were the AAA for the aging, as far as what these most correspond to.
And Representative Loeffler, this, with the addition of the amendment, this is actually going to be referred not to finance but to GovOps. Because there is a commission's being established now. And so maybe this is something that we can work. I mean, I think you've raised some interesting questions. Maybe this is something we can work forward as we go there.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Liebling, I'd be glad to do that. One model that has been used effectively in some other programs is that you just establish a minimum size in terms of population or whatever so that you still maintain that effectiveness, but then you allow people to submit to the state agency suggestions as to who should be grouped together or how what might happen. I mean, I just don't like it when we impose things that just don't fit and they break up natural alliances. And sometimes it's hard when you're working in that state agency office, whether it's Department of Education or Department of Human Services or whatever, to really understand those local relationships.
Thank you. Further questions, members? Representative Shumper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to understand this. Prior to the establishment of the Region 10 Quality Assurance in 1998, the commissioner, I assume, of Human Services did all the quality assurance licensing?
Any of the witnesses?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shumper, yes. Licensing was performed by the Department of Human Services, and the Region 10 Quality Assurance Project was created as an alternative to the current licensing system.
And that occurred in 1998. And then looking at the 908, the original here, said that effective July 1st, that's on line or page 1, line 22, in 2003, you kind of opened this up that any county or group could essentially set up something similar to the Region 10 process, correct? Did any groups do that? Any alternative licensing groups formed as a result of that?
Mrs. Zimmer?
Currently, we have not seen another county opt into an alternative licensing system. In the last 2 years, we've established three different pilot projects that are using voice and going forward with a quality assurance system. They are just beginning in that process of that expansion, and we're hopeful that that will continue to grow and counties will decide to opt into alternative licensing system. But at this point, no county has stepped forward to change their system.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions, members? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Liebling and the testifiers. I just want to thank you for bringing this, what sounds like good bipartisan work, forward for consideration. It's useful, and I wanted to thank you.
And Representative Liebling or someone, this will ultimately end up in finance. Can you get a little bit more detail on what the CMS is requiring? And maybe that'll be in the full report, but just so we kind of understand that relationship, I think that would help. So you don't have to comment on that. Thank you. Seeing no further questions, members, Representative Anderson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. It talks about federal Medicaid match obtained for the purpose of the shall be dedicated to the commissioner. Is that right now situation where this amendment that we're putting on here for regional and state commission, is there something in federal law now that would correlate to this piece of legislation that's being presented?
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, if I understand your question correctly, what this would do is allow the state to access and utilize medical assistance funds to create their or work on their quality efforts or whatever right now. So the report emphasizes that funding is available in order for us to try to come into compliance with what CMS is asking us to do. But it would require some new state dollars in order to initiate this effort.
Representative Anderson.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Larson, the money will come into the state. The commissioner then will based on the regional setup and the state commission setup, the quality commission, divvy out the money that comes from the federal government according to the needs within these regions.
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, essentially that's correct, yes. There'll be, as you'll look in the last page of the report, we have analyzed, along with the technical assistance of the Department of Human Services in putting the report together, what it would cost to fund each of the regions. However, don't be overwhelmed by those numbers on the last page of that executive summary, because we're trying to phase this in over several years.
Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I applaud your attempts, but the sad thing is we did have some great regions around the state, and they were dismantled. And they were working great. We were cooperating within each region in a really great way, and we fought really hard to keep them. And they were other parts of, at least one part of the state that wasn't working, so we dismantled all of them. And so I feel bad that we are now reinventing a wheel that was very successful in at least the rural areas. I realized that there was a report that was that we were supposed to get. Could we get the final report? Because I think when we were sort of upset about losing what we had, we at least wanted a report that we could look at to see how we're going to because all of that infrastructure is now gone. The people that were there, and we have to start all over. And maybe that's why they're not really wanting to do anything, because would they get dismantled again?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Larson,
and Representative Otremba, we certainly will get you the quality assurance report. We think it'll be out of the department in the next month. This is also consistent with what the recommendations were in the recent legislative auditor's report, asking for more regional initiatives to make sure that services were provided in an equitable manner across the state for persons with disabilities as well as other client populations.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Schumper. Representative Schumper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there going to be any unfunded county mandates connected with this?
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schumper, that's exactly what we're trying to avoid. And in fact, there's a representation on the committee made sure that we don't want to duplicate activities either. And that's a good example in one of your earlier questions, too, is that as we're looking for an outcome-based licensing system eventually, but we don't want to duplicate efforts that are going on so that we have more requirements on individuals, we feel that we need to have a planful manner in which we transition into a different way of looking at how we're looking at quality, and we need to fund that with medical assistance dollars that's required by CMS, and we need to do it in a manner in which we don't overburden the current system, but instead listen to consumers and meet their individual goals. So we think it can be done. It's being done. Steps of this are being accomplished in Massachusetts as far as the regional model, and the Region 10 Quality Assurance Project has been recognized nationally for its efforts. So we think taking best practices from around the country and including in Minnesota, we can get that accomplished.
Further discussion, members? Seeing none, Representative Liebling will renew her motion that House File 908, as amended, be recommended to pass, and it will be re-referred to the Government Operations Committee. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion adopted. Thank you. All right. Next. Representative Fritz, House File 313. And Representative Fritz will move that House File 313 be recommended to pass and re-referred to taxes.
Correct.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
And you also have a delete amendment, a DE1 amendment.
I do.
Do you want to move that be incorporated?
I do.
All right, Representative Fritz moves that the DE1 amendment be adopted. Move the amendment. All in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The amendment is adopted, and the bill, as the author wanted, is before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 313 is a bill that establishes a program to provide income tax credits to certain caregivers. I'll just a little background. I have experience in this. I had my mother living with me for 10 months before she died. I took a leave of absence from my work without pay, and as my mother, so I was happy to do that. And my neighbor across the street, who is a young 48-year-old widow, had her mother, who of 90 years old. The mother lived in her own home and was able to live in her own home and was receiving some services, but the daughter spent every day at that home providing care for that mother. The mother was off. I think there were five stays in the hospital, and then to the nursing home, and then back home again. And the mother died in the home with the daughter on the couch, and that was her will, and for nothing. You know, we do these things for our mothers, but there are folks who are there every day for their dad, their uncle, their brother. I have two lovely Norwegian bachelors. That's a term I don't think we hear very much anymore, but two bachelors that live in my district, and they have taken care of each other in the farm all of their life. And Philip had a stroke, and his brother Paul cared for him in the home. And that does go on. That continues to go on. So this is just a little help for those folks that are helping their loved ones so that they could, I think the amount of the tax, the amount that they would put on their income tax would be up to $2,400 for 20 hours a week. And believe me, it's more than that for most of these folks. And it would enable the care, the patient or resident to stay in their home for as long as they could. And they would be certified by a team from the county. When I had my mother, I had the team come out to the house and give her all the tests that need be. And she passed them mostly with flying colors. However, she definitely was in need of care. And I was able to do that as a nurse in my home. But there are many people who aren't nurses who could still care for their loved ones and should have a tax credit for doing so. And I have a couple of testifiers to talk to this issue. Please go ahead.
Joan Molinar here with the MS Society. My husband with the red and multicolored lap robe on is here with me. I've been his chief PCA, unpaid, for 25 plus years. He's been in a wheelchair since 1980. He's had MS since the early 70s. And because I was able to help and care for him, he was able to work longer. I drove him to work because we could not depend upon the transportation system. But what is bringing me here today is you do it lovingly, because when you say I do, you say I do, whether it's for good or for ill. But what brings me here today is to speak on behalf of a lot of families who are in the same situation, whether it's your spouse or your child or a parent or grandparent. You do this care uncompensated, and you don't have time to go out and have a job. We are now at a stage in our household where the proverbial month doesn't meet in the middle. So I spent some time to see if I could find even a part-time job, 12 to 15 hours a week, maybe 3 hours or 4 hours at a time. And I wasn't able to, and by rights, I probably couldn't, because one employer could say, gee, you can work for me, but I had to call him or her at 10 o'clock. I wasn't finished with the morning routines with my husband. Sorry, I can't come in till 10:30. What employer who needs reliability could say, okay, I needed to run off because he ended up having a crisis medical appointment he had to get to, because in the morning he got up with a fever, woke up with a fever. And so, excuse me, I have to leave early today. I can't give my 3 hours or 4 hours. And that's what many families experience, is because you have an unreliable schedule, even though you try hard to keep a schedule. Today it's 2 hours to get through the morning routines. Tomorrow it's 2.5 or 3.5 hours, or something occurs during the day, so then you, or whatever the issue is. Families do end up in those situations where a caregiver is unemployed, and they end up making financial decisions and go without whatever it is they have to go without in order for somebody to stay home to take care of that family member. But for my taking care, and the deal is we have, he has just enough income so we don't qualify for aid or assistance. But if I went to work, I would pay everything out for and more for his care, or he would be in a nursing home, because he is a full care person. we lovingly do that for our people, our family members, but that's the situation. And this probably would help many to have that little extra to make the financial situations work for families. Thank you. Any questions? I'd be glad to respond. Otherwise, I'm not the expert other than I'm expert at giving care to my loved one.
Well, thank you for coming.
I would also like to add one point.
Yeah.
Not solicited. I heard issues of, in a previous bill, about using safe techniques to take care of. I've tried to practice them for 25 years. I'm still suffering the consequences of trying to practice them for 25 years, even though I went for training early on. So it is a reality that you are dealing with and looking at that issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, members? Thank you for coming down. Additional
I have another testifier. I think Mr. Chung had something
Mr. Chung.
To say on.
Mr. Chair and members, I just did want to point out a correction that needs to be made in the Delete All amendment. On page 2 of the amendment, on line 19, the sentence reading, an individual may claim only one credit in any tax year, should be deleted.
Okay. Representative Fritz, do you want to make, I'll make the motion that that amendment be adopted. It's on lane 2.19, the language, an individual may claim only one credit in any tax year is being deleted. Any questions on that, members?
Is that correct, Mr. Chung? Okay, good.
Okay.
Thank you.
All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Ms. Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. In another substitution on a snowy day, I will be speaking for Jane Okramovich. My name is Iris Freeman, testifying on behalf of the Alzheimer's Association. You should have Ms. Okramovich's statement in your packet, and I shall do the best I can to be in her stead. We are, as an association, grateful to Representative Frist for her leadership in enacting a homestead tax credit, and we enthusiastically voice our support today. The overwhelming percentage of care for people with Alzheimer's disease occurs at home. The research data have figures in the 75% or 80 range. Family caregivers are indeed the first line of dementia care, and too often the emotional and financial stresses turn into crises, costly crises. And I should also note that with an upswing in the diagnosis of dementia among younger people, young onset, early onset diagnoses of dementia, people in their 40s and 50s, we're talking about careers and earnings that are drastically interrupted. Even in the recent past, a joint report issued by the National Alliance for Caregiving and the Alzheimer's Association a few years ago documented that the majority of Alzheimer's caregivers do work full or part-time. Two-thirds of working caregivers reported that they missed work because of caregiving responsibilities. Of those, 14% gave up jobs or chose early retirement. 3% cut back on work hours or took a less demanding job. 8% turned down a promotion, and 7% lost job benefits. Again, depressed income. The pressures and the frustrations experienced by caregivers are far-reaching. And yet, from a public policy perspective, failure to enact laws like this that stand by family caregivers means that more and more of the cost of caring for chronically ill adults will fall on the already strained Medicaid program. House File 313 takes an important step in responding to the needs of low-income family caregivers with a tax credit that can ease the financial stress. The bill provides the dollars that can make a difference when earnings drop and the cost of care mounts. We support the premise that the tax credit be focused on those situations where the caregiver is providing absolutely essential daily care and that limitations be based on need. While it's not necessarily ideal, policy has to identify priorities. The comment that we had with respect to the proposed caregiver burden scale is taken care of in the delete all amendment, so there is no need for me to speak to that. But I should mention just one more item, and that is we support the requirement in what was Section 3, Subdivision 7, that calls for caregiver training. We recommend, however, that instead of requiring that the caregiver attend 8 hours of training, education, counseling, or caregiver support sessions, let us, in this electronic age, say, participate in these supports. Sometimes relief has to come by telephone. Information has to come by telephone, and that's particularly crucial in those types of cases where both the caregiver and the person with dementia are, for all practical purposes, both homebound. Thank you very much for moving this bill closer to law.
Thank you, Ms. Fearon. Any questions, members? Representative Fritz, what do you think of... well, maybe we should leave that for tax committee to see in terms of administering the program that changed from attend to participate in. But thank you for that.
Okay.
Yes, Representative Anderson.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Talking about caregiver training, I know that when my wife and I took in her father to live in our home, the county would send in a nurse at least once a week to just check on things and see. Would it be possible that if the person was qualified, give training to the family members at that time rather than making them? It says must attend at least 8 hours of caregiver training, but I mean, if there could be some kind of qualification where a person in home could get that training, like on-the-job training.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just making it as a suggestion because sometimes it's not, you're not capable to get away.
Right.
As already was mentioned, you're dealing with that person on a rigorous, plus you're trying to, and so it's very tough for someone taking care of their loved one to get out and do that.
Ms. Freeman.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Anderson, that is very, very similar to the point that I was making. Certainly those nurses' visits with instruction for the family caregiver ought to count every bit as much as leaving the house to go to a place. It is very, very commonplace for a visiting nurse, hospice nurse, mm-hmm. to come in and show the family ways that will be comfortable or safe or just more effective in providing a hands-on care.
Representative,
absolutely. In the instance that I gave with my neighbor, the young widow woman taking care of her mother, they had the nurse visit as well, and then at the end the hospice people. And this is where they learn how to transfer and what sort of foods at the end stages of her life. And all of it, the medications and all of that. So yes, I think that is going on right now. I think we ought to count that as a CEU towards this training for the caregiver.
Well, Representative Fritz and Representative Anderson, why don't we just change attend to participate in? Because I think that actually may capture what you're trying to get at. And if we need to change language again, we can work on that. But so I would move that on line 3.2, we delete the word attend and insert or add the language after must, the language participate in.
Good.
Does everybody understand that amendment? All right. All in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? That amendment is adopted. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fritz, thank you for bringing this forward. As we're going to see when I get to testifying on our tax credit bill on long-term care coverage, the dollars and where we're headed with this as a state, we have got to start looking at other ways of delivering care and acknowledging what's going on right now in homes all across the state of Minnesota. My only one concern as I looked at it was Subdivision 3 on long-term care consultation team. It feels a bit prescriptive to tell them who has to be in those teams, and I'm wondering if there are already, Representative Anderson just mentioned the fact that we have county nurses, public health nurses coming into homes, and I'm wondering if it has to be made up of two people or whether we can allow for more flexibility than is in here for people to simply come in and make sure that they're doing these. I get that part of it because we want to make sure people aren't just taking advantage of the tax credit and not doing the stuff that they need to be doing. But Could there be more flexibility in that?
And Representative Gottwell, these teams already exist. And what this is for is not so much to check on what is going on, but to screen to make sure that the service, the person is being cared for, would otherwise be going into a nursing facility. I mean, I think part of the goal here is that we're actually saving money to the state by avoiding institutional placements. And so it's something you have to go through anyway. It's a pre-existing entity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was reading that as new language just now. Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Fritz, I want to direct your attention to the Subdivision 2, or actually Subdivision 3 of the bill, where you define who the service recipient is. And it's defined in that subpart 1 there as with certain relationships to the taxpayer. And I'm wondering, you know, what the reason is behind that and why you would limit it in that way. Because, for instance, what if the taxpayer, you know, what if you're cared for by your cousin or your aunt or your uncle or just a really good friend? I mean, why limit it? You know, if a person is providing the care and the person who's receiving the care is otherwise qualified here, why are we limiting it only to these? Maybe there's a tax reason for that. I don't know. But could you explain that?
Representative Fritz?
Well, I guess that's about my own experience and my constituents. Those are the folks that are doing it that I know of, and I'm open to, you know, I suppose friends. And I'm the daughter that did it, and it's usually the daughter that ends up doing it.
Representative Walker.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that, Representative Liebling. I think Representative Fritz, it is the majority who are, I won't say daughter, I will say child, or, you know, your daughter-in-law, things of that nature. However, Representative Liebling is right. When she said it, I was sitting here thinking about my cousin, his wife just had a major stroke in her 40s, and my cousin, not her daughter, but her niece, has been at the hospital every day and making sure that she gets out of the hospital and to getting back home and to her children as soon as possible. So there are different family members depending on your family situation. This particular cousin, it is her family is still down south, and so it is up to our family to mend her and get her back to health in whatever time availability we have.
Representative Walker, thank you for that, and Representative Thiessen, I'm just hearing from one of the testifiers here that are there any tax issues with that? I don't know. I'm sure we'll find this out when we get to taxes.
Right, this is going to taxes. I don't know the answer to that question, so Representative Liebling.
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, given that we don't know the answer, I guess I would make a motion to strike that subpart 1. I don't know if subpart is the right.
Lines 2.8 and 2.9.
Yes, thank you. 2.8 and 2.9, just to strike that language. And I'm sure when it gets to taxes, if there's a tax reason why we need to limit it, then I'm sure that the tax committee will figure that out.
Okay, members, to the Liebling amendments, any further discussion on that?
Representative,
Mr. Chair, and I'm speaking just strictly on knowledge and not a practicing tax person or a lawyer or anything, but I think when there are any issues of reimbursing or any issues of credits right now federally, you have to be related to the person. If there are any waiver reimbursements or anything, so and I'm just advising you that that is an issue that needs to be clarified.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, members, you do have to have some kind of a designee that you put in place, whether it's, as Representative Liebling mentioned, a friend or someone, but they have to, you know, to take care of, even though you may be related, there has to be something that is to get reimbursement for this. You have to have some kind of a designee there. So you would have to put some kind of language in there to specify a person or individual, and it has to be qualified by the people that are going to come and be watching over you or taking you in consideration to get that credit back from the federal. So
okay.
There's going to have to be some kind of language either left in there or something. Mm-hmm. to replace that language.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, actually, I'm on the tax committee, and I would withdraw the amendment at this time, and then we can deal with that in taxes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Liebling, hopefully you do figure it out, because we're just sitting here. Grandchild's not on here as something that is quite common. And the whole issue of do you have to live in the household or not. And some people are living in the household with, you know, I've already told my best friend, I'm like, you need to save money because you will be taking care of me. period. No matter where you live, no matter what husband you have, just know I need a wing in your house because I have picked fields that don't offer a lot of pay. So that is going to be my friend. And so I will be living with her.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Walker, Mr. Representative Walker, the issue about whether you should be living in the household, that might be a policy issue that you might want to deal with here. I don't know, but there are some other relationships. I mean, as I look at this, it does, this really helps people who have children. You know, I mean, that's really what it comes down to. And we know there are many, many people, elderly people who never had children, and then the relationships, sometimes those primary family relationships aren't the ones in this direct kind of a tree. So there are policy issues here apart from the tax issues, and I don't know if you want to add something to deal with that.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Walker.
I have enough going on. Okay. I will let you do it in the tax committee.
All right. I appreciate that. Thank you. Well, Representative
I think you have the sense of the committee.
I do.
Generally.
I very much. And I have another testifier.
Yes, no, I know. Ms.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Oh, Representative Cummins, did you have a question? I'm sorry.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Fritz. I do some respite care, and there are some couples out there who can't afford the nurse. And so it's very difficult because they have to pay for the nurse and they can't afford it. And so how would that take care of 3.2 on 3 when it says participant? I know periodically I maybe can get that person to a doctor or whatever, but there are people out there that are in that situation who do not have money to let the public health nurse come.
Representative Fritz?
Representative Otremba, and I can understand that I have constituents that are in the same predicament. Of course, they are screened by the county, by the team, and then services that they would qualify for would be available for them. So I would hope that would be addressed in the initial screening. That's why I like the part of having to have the screening before that.
And Representative Trumbull, some of the research on this shows that, I mean, if one of our goals is, because we're investing state money here, that's kind of the idea here, to keep people at home instead of in institutions, mm-hmm. that this kind of training and support actually extends the time that people can stay in their home. I think that we're probably going to be looking at another piece of legislation that will expand access to respite care in general, because that's another piece of this picture, and I think you make a very good point.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it becomes money for them, and they don't have that money. They want that money for some other caregiving thing, and the public nurse is too expensive, and so then they go without, and you may have that initial screening. I don't know if they'll have to pay for it. I mean, sometimes it can be a money issue, and so we do have to kind of really figure out how to do that.
Yeah, and I'm not sure. I don't think the screening, actually. I think that first initial screening is, to qualify for MA, you'd have to go through that. I don't think there's a charge for that. That's my understanding, but there's issues probably with anyway.
Right, and we need to address that area.
Thanks, Representative Trump. Ms. Kessel.
Okay. Good afternoon. Thank you, Representative Thiessen, who actually is my representative from my community, and I'm Kay Kessel, and this is my husband, Lay Kessel, over here. And I'm a 24-hour caregiver, and I have been for almost 5 years. And I'm here representing other caregivers that have their spouses going to Mount Olivet Day Program. And one of the women was going to come, and I'm here in her stead. When she started to write down what her life was like, it was too overwhelming, and she was in such pain she could not come and speak to you. She's been a caregiver for her husband, who has Parkinson's, for over 25 years. She had to go to an Al-Anon meeting for support because there just weren't support groups for her. And her husband has medical care. He's on the waiver. She is not 60 yet, and she has no health care. And it's a tragedy. And anyway, I'm going to tell you a little my story. I'm a caregiver for my husband and soulmate, Lay Kessel. On August 5th, 2002, Lay had a stroke while we were up north at a cabin. He was already disabled and used a wheelchair because of complications from a brain injury at age 19. However, he was independent and used a motorized wheelchair to get around our neighborhood, and he entertained himself while I worked. I had retired the month before his stroke from the Minneapolis Public Schools and immediately became a full-time caregiver. I was told that Lay would need 24-hour care and that my choices were to send him to a nursing home or have him come home with me. So what does a full-time caregiver mean? It means getting your husband up into the bathroom every morning, dressing him, feeding him, getting him into the car if you're going anywhere. Unfortunately, Lay's stroke took away his previous independence, and he relies totally on me. He's lucky I'm a strong woman. All these same activities are repeated at night in reverse order. Caregiving also increases the stress level every time you hit another bump in the road. A few months ago, I had a breast biopsy. While waiting for the results, I was more worried about what I would do with Lay than what would happen to me. It's important to note that I'm not helpless type. I have degrees in home economics education and secondary school administration. I was an assistant principal in the Minneapolis schools for 15 years. My work experience included finding services for students that had a variety of needs, and yet I couldn't find services for myself. And I want to tell you, 2 years ago, watching this very committee on television, because Lay was home ill, I learned about the Block Nurse Program, about Catholic Charities, about all kinds of programs, the Elderberry Program. We're not eligible in our Southwest neighborhood for a Block Nurse Program, but I did get connected to Catholic Charities, so you were providing a great service having your hearings televised. I just want to say I'm very angry about Health and Human Services personnel leading the AIDS Wave public interviews. And I went to one over in North Minneapolis because they seem to think that we have everything in place for caregivers here in Minnesota. When Lay was released from the Knapp Center at Hennepin County Medical Center in 2002, neither the social worker nor the health professionals connected me to any services to help me learn to be a caregiver. This is what I was sent away with, no help or instruction. Thank goodness for friends. One of mine told me about Mount Olivet Day services, and before Lay left Hennepin County Medical Center, he was enrolled at Mount Olivet. He has gone there 3 days a week ever since. This has been my salvation. All my retirement, travel, and retirement dreams take place during my 3 days of respite for caregiving, care receiving, which we experience there. Guess what? I come to the legislature, and I'm a League of Women Voters lobbyist monitoring for education finance. And I want money for caregivers, but I also want all the kindergarten and money for special ed and money for early childhood. I just had to put that in. In the 4 years since the stroke, I've had only 2 separate weeks of vacation when my husband went into respite because of the cost and limited options. More often than not, I couldn't get the information to refer me to resources that would have helped in so many ways. This experience was not isolated to any one agency or organization. Dr. Wayne Caron, University of Minnesota professor, has started a caregiving, care-receiving support group that is much researched, and he is a program that is unique in the whole country. And he has started a group for us over at Mount Olivet. Please do not put a new intern in charge of leading a caregiving support group. We deserve someone who has walked in our shoes and has done the research. And I want to say about the 8 hours of training, with 4.5 years times 24 hours, you know, give me, you know, the training. I think people are unrealistic when you realize what we're doing. And actually, my husband did fall one time, and I never lift him. He pulled himself up, and we couldn't get him up, and so we had to call 911. That's the option that you have. And the firemen came. No one reached out to me from the NAP Center or any other agency, but I learned about the TBI waiver from another Mount Olivet caregiver. Lay temporarily went on the waiver, and with the spend down, I had to pay $60 per hour for the home health aide who came to our house for respite. I paid $1,000 per month for Mount Olivet, $300 per hour for a psychologist who came to our home, and it would cost $2,400 for a week of respite. How much better? We didn't stay on the waiver program. It just didn't work for us. But how much better to have the consumer-driven funding so we caregivers could make that $240 that would take for one night to stretch that to 24 hours with a Catholic Charities volunteer. If you want to talk about fraud, our Hennepin County social worker and the agency that placed the home health aide in our house were indicted for fraud. That was in the paper. So there's money to be made with our government funds, and I think people need to trust us with this tax credit. That $2,400 is immensely important to people. In the 4 years since Lay's stroke, I had 2 weeks of vacation. My sister-in-law suggested that I take a trip when Lay was hospitalized 4 times last year from May to July. Due to a third hospitalization, he was eligible to be in a rehab center nursing home for 3 weeks. You might think the 3 weeks would be a respite for me. Lay was in a highly rated facility, one I would choose if something happened to me. I did not take a trip. I was there 3 times a day to make sure my husband was okay. He was put in diapers and left in bed alone except when he was in rehab. He has memory loss and couldn't remember to press the bell when he needed to go to the bathroom. Thus, he was put in diapers. I had to help feed him. Needless to say, I wouldn't choose that facility, which is one of the star ratings, now for a nursing home. It was such a relief to have him home and to be back in our routine, knowing he's well cared for. I have nobody else in our house that helps me with that. What else does a full-time caregiver mean? It also means being heartbroken and terrified all the same time. Terrified on a number of counts, not the least of which is financial. We were both 62 years old when Lay had his stroke, and we did have health care coverage. And now with Medicare and supplemental insurance, we do have health coverage. I just want to say I'm very grateful to my representative, Paul Thiessen, and Representative Patty Fritz for recognizing the needs of caregivers. The Brain Injury Foundation invited me to testify today. I also want to thank the Multiple Sclerosis Society, Minnesota Board of Aging, United Cerebral Palsy, and Minnesota Association of Area Agencies on Aging for sponsoring the first Caregiver Appreciation Dinner in Minnesota in November. Suzanne Fritz, president of the National Caregivers Association, spoke at the dinner. She said, "We caregivers must take care of our health first, and we must get organized to promote laws to help caregivers." Well, this is one of them. Some of the caregivers in our group at Mount Olivet have health care for their care receiver, but not for them. I just want to say, no matter what disease or disabling condition our care receivers have, our caregivers' lives have common threads. We are isolated, depressed, exhausted, and we need coaching and caregiving from somewhere to keep going. That there shouldn't be inequality between disability organizations and having the resources to support caregivers. There are far more strokes than brain injuries or multiple sclerosis. Why shouldn't stroke victims and their caregivers receive packets and resources that persons with head injuries do now? You have passed a law that medical people have to notify the Brain Injury Foundation when there is a head injury. When someone is diagnosed with Alzheimer's or has stroke, the family should be contacted and become part of a caregiving coalition. I'll stop there. Anyway, I thank,
well, thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you for coming down today. Further questions, members? Representative Shumper.
Just one quick one, Mr. Chairman. Representative Fritz, how did you arrive at the $2,400 per month?
Well, we talked about it. 20 hours, I think, a week, and $200. I added up, and that's just sort of the number we agreed upon to begin with.
Okay, Representative Murphy. No, President Waffle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative. This is a really important issue because it is the underpinning of our entire care system, is people caring for each other. And the research actually shows that if you're male, that your best long-term care insurance policy is to have a wife that's dedicated to you. And I think our last witness just proved that.
Yeah.
If you're female, your absolute best long-term care insurance policy is a daughter who lives nearby you. And if you can't have that, you have to have a daughter-in-law that lives nearby. But for the people who don't have children or whose children are at the other end of the country, that's the reason why the provision in this bill was put in, that counties must offer long-term care consultation to anyone who doesn't, no matter what their income is, because people without family or without family nearby would, and I know several horror stories of people who put an ad in the paper looking for someone and they got ripped off by that person. So that was put in there. But there was never any money that accompanied that responsibility to our counties. The only money for long-term care consultation is an assessment to the nursing homes. I don't know that they want to pick up this whole responsibility. So as this moves forward, I'll be working with Patty and the nursing home industry and others to try and figure out a good way to support this so that it works for everybody. But I think this is just, we're going to have to keep shoring up this part of the service system.
Thank you, Representative Laufer.
Any further questions?
No.
Representative Instead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this will be quick, and I do not mean this at all to be political or whatnot. I'm just thinking through this, and as I hear the testimony, I have a ton of respect for the folks that testified, and thank you for what you do for your loved ones. I kept thinking back to my wife, who's at home in a blizzard, our primary caregiver to our children.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about the tax credits, and I think about what my wife provides my family.
Mm-hmm.
And our society by doing what she does. I went down the list: care, dependency, reliable care, loss of income, leaving the workforce, and so on and so forth. I mean, this, as you were putting this together, did you think more globally?
Oh.
I know this is a pressing area and a pressing issue, but, look at that end of the spectrum also. Have you talked about that?
Representative Thiessen and Representative Finseth, that's right up my alley. I've talked about that for years. What the wife and mother, we don't pay them at home. They don't make any money. That's why we have to go to work. And that I think is what is a big problem with my grandchildren and the young folks we're raising today. So yes, I am very much aware of that area.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Fritz, I'll look forward to your bill.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Fritz renews her motion, the House File
313,
as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Taxes.
All right. Thank you.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. Thank you, Representative
Fritz.
Thank you. And all the testifiers. Representative Gottwald, House File 309.
You want to go first?
I don't care. Representative Hamilton.
Representative Walker gave me 2 minutes.
House Bill 1073. Okay, yes. The weather's going poorly, so if we could just, quicker the better, I suppose.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 1073, and can we refer that to the General Register?
Can I? Yeah, it has to go. Let's look at it. I'll look at it while you present the bill.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And like I said, Representative Walker is timing me. She gave me 2 minutes. So this requires the Department of Human Services to notify physicians and others before removing a drug from the formula due to failure of a manufacturer to sign a rebate agreement. 60-day notification is requested. And I'd just like to point out, do a little name drop in here. I have Chair Huntley, Chair Thiessen on this bill, Representative Anderson, and, of course, myself. So hopefully that'll help speed things along. There is a letter of support from NAMI, and actually it's still sitting over there. If we could get that passed out, that'd be great. They're just, once again, want to share their support. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them at this point in time.
Is there any testimony from the audience on this bill? I think we got to refer to finance just in case, and then if not, I just don't know if the 60 days is going to make a difference. So the motion will be that the bill be recommended passed and be referred to finance. Any questions, members? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hamilton, I don't know too much about this, but what's the practical effect of doing this? What does it mean to the practitioners?
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Liebling. You know, people need to have notification if their medications are no longer available. And this helps make that necessary changes. You know, it gives them a point of time, 60 days, to where if this prescription or if this drug is going to be removed, then they can have 60 days to be able to determine what their next step's going to be.
And Representative Liebling, I think the letter from NAMI kind of talks about a little bit about some of the issues underlying this, but that's essentially it, is it allows time to get to your doctor to get a new prescription, those types of things.
Thank you.
No, I understand that. Any other questions, members? All right. All in favor of Representative Hamilton will renew his motion that House File 1073 be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee. All in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Did he make it, Representative Walker?
You guys slowed him down, but he made it.
All right. Now, Representative Gottwald.
Aye.
And Representative Gottwald will move that House File 309 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Taxes. House File 309 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Taxes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think under Representative Woffler's comment earlier, I may be losing my best long-term care insurance pretty soon if we don't get moving. So we will keep this brief. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. Steve Gottwald, District 15A. And with me, some testifiers as well. We'll move quickly. State governments across the nation are becoming acutely aware of the increasing costs of medical care for the elderly and disabled. Many observers see a huge financial crisis looming as our baby boom generation ages and Medicaid costs grow. States like us will be spending more and more of our budgets to cover these costs. Encouraging individuals to purchase long-term care insurance is seen as one important solution to this crisis. Current tax incentives here and across the nation are simply too insignificant right now to encourage people to buy their own long-term care coverage. House File 309 presents a substantial boost to Minnesota's existing tax credit incentive, a boost that recent research suggests would make long-term care coverage more attractive to baby boomers, preserving their quality care options and potentially saving Minnesota many times the tax credit in spiraling Medicaid costs. And I'll let our testifiers introduce themselves as we move ahead. I avoided killing more trees and burdening you with more paper by putting some things on the slides here. There's a new study out. If you haven't seen it, I encourage you to visit it online, the Ecumen AgeWave study. I'm not even going to read this. There we go. Ecumen, by the way, is Minnesota's largest nonprofit senior housing company, if you're wondering who they are. And this was completed just this past January 2007. This is the coming cost crunch, folks. DHS estimates it could cost Minnesota state government more than $20 billion by the year 2050, about the time I'm going to need long-term care coverage if we don't change how we pay for senior care. More than half of baby boomers, 56% under the survey, the Ecumen survey, say that a $500 plus tax credit would be enough of an incentive to help persuade them to buy long-term care insurance. And as I mentioned earlier, less than that really doesn't do much good. Nearly 9 out of 10 baby boomers, 85%, would support a proposal that includes increased tax credit for long-term care insurance. And again, this is a survey of Minnesota seniors, the largest survey of its kind to date in Minnesota. The benefits of this House File 309, lower Medicaid costs by covering more individuals with private insurance. Fewer persons may reassign their assets through trusts and gifts to get onto MA. That's the standard financial planning lingo right now, is when you get to that point in your life, sell off all your assets, jump on medical assistance. Some nursing homes will not accept MA patients. It's not many, but this increases options again. So, with that having been said, I'd like to introduce Dominic Spizzetto with Independent Insurance Agents and has some testimony on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, Dominic Spizzetto, I'm here today representing the Minnesota Independent Insurance Agents and also the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, who are insurance agents that sell long-term care insurance in Minnesota. When long-term care insurance was first enacted in the mid-80s, the legislature was somewhat apprehensive of this as a product. It was new. It was somewhat confusing. It was different, and so it took us a year or so to get it passed in Minnesota, and we had to go through a lot of compromises with the Attorney General's Office and the Minnesota Senior Federation, and of course, being from Lake Wobegon, we wanted to make sure that all of our bills are above average, and in doing so, we put in a lot of benefits and a lot of consumer protections, which unfortunately resulted in us lagging behind the rest of the country because insurance companies wouldn't sell the product in Minnesota because it was so much different than the national model. Not only that, but we had a social service system, including the Attorney General, the Department of Human Services, our social service agencies, that were telling people not to buy long-term care insurance and to spend down and qualify for medical assistance. In fact, there was a mini industry out there with elder care attorneys and even some of my own members holding seminars on showing people how to transfer their assets and spend down, so when they had to go into a nursing home, they would look poor and qualify for medical assistance. And these people weren't necessarily poor. They were middle class. The legislature and the Department of Human Services and the information that Representative Gottwald showed you is the state can't afford to continue to do that. And so we changed our attitude towards private long-term care insurance. We cleaned up our law. We made it more compatible with laws in the other states, and our products started to become more attractive. In 1999, we instituted a tax credit. It's a $100 tax credit. It's actually up to $100. It'll pay a quarter of your premium up to that amount. And that has had some but not much of an impact on the long-term care insurance marketplace. Last year, the legislature, thanks to Representative Abler and others, passed a proposal to authorize a long-term care partnership, which is a public-private partnership that would give people an opportunity to buy long-term care insurance, and when they exhaust their benefits, to take a dollar-per-dollar offset from that amount of money and shield that from the spend-down requirements for medical assistance. We are, and I'm hopeful, we've been working with both the Department of Commerce and the Department of Human Services. I'm hopeful that we'll have this program up and running in Minnesota within a couple of months. However, the long-term care credit is also a very attractive means of encouraging our people, our middle class, to purchase long-term care insurance in Minnesota, and I would encourage your support of this proposal.
Thank you. Ms. Claire.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Margaret LeClaire. I have a doctorate in economics, and I focus on a variety of health care issues. I'm also a business owner here in St. Paul, and an important part of my business is educating people about planning for the day when they may need long-term care services and selling long-term care insurance. I can report to you that people are concerned about the cost of care in the long term. Minnesotans, especially middle-class Minnesotans, are interested in buying long-term care insurance and subsequently not needing to become a part of the medical assistance program when the day comes that they need help in paying for nursing homes or other home health care services. But people are worried about the cost of long-term care insurance. The average premium today is $1,300 annually. It can go as high as $4,000 or $5,000 annually, depending on the age of which you buy the insurance. So it makes sense that the state would create more incentives and offer more help to people that want to take the responsibility and buy long-term care insurance and subsequently not place their long-term care needs on medical assistance. And obviously the ultimate advantage to the state by increasing the incentive to buy long-term care insurance is for pennies on the dollar shifting the responsibility of paying for long-term care from the government to the insurance companies and saving medical assistance millions of dollars in the long run.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Otumba.
Thank you. I have a few questions. First of all, how many years does that pay for?
How many
years of nursing home?
How many years of service? A policy today would typically cover 4 years of service at that price.
Representative Trump. Oh.
Mr. Chair, what about the person that, you know, there's a small percentage of people who've done all the right things.
Right.
They've purchased long-term care, and they end up with Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
What does your policy do for them?
Ms. LeClaire.
Well, I don't think that's, this is the percentage of people, well, to answer your question, long-term care insurance pays for care of Alzheimer's patients, and there aren't any policies on the market today that don't cover Alzheimer's. Nobody should consider endorsing one or buying one. Absolutely.
Representative Tremblay?
Chair, so how many years of Alzheimer's in the nursing home would your long-term care policy pay for?
Ms. LeClaire.
Right. Alzheimer's is a progressive disease, and long-term care insurance typically pays for the continuum of care. So somebody who has Alzheimer's does not immediately check into a nursing home. As we've heard today from various caregivers, care first starts in the home. And long-term care insurance does also pay for that care in the home. As the person progresses through the disease and needs increasing levels of care in various facilities, that long-term care insurance follows them through that continuum of care. Now, long-term care insurance policies, you can get a policy for 3 years, 5 years, you can get a lifetime policy, but these policies get more and more expensive, which goes to the core question of helping people afford these types of insurance policies, which obviously people need, as we've heard from so many caregivers today.
Mr. Chair, if I might, on that topic again, Representative Otremba, again, the idea here is if we can get people who need this kind of care coverage on this, spend some state dollars up front to do this, we are still going to save a lot of money on the backside and be able to preserve resources for people who really need it. Many people, through long-term care coverage, are able to provide for their needs at the end of life when they end up in a nursing home.
Well, Mr. Chair, I know about long-term care. I know a lot about long-term care insurance. I also know that there are some states working on, if you do all the right things, you buy your long-term care, 3 years, I think, is what they're looking at other states. If you've done all the right things, then the state doesn't take your assets away to get Medicare. Are you working on that kind of stuff too within the state? Because I think, what really is happening is the very wealthy don't need it. The very poor don't need it. And it's the middle class who's taking the brunt. They're the people who paid, who built our schools, built our roads, our churches, and then they're the ones that lose all of their assets. And so I've been pretty adamant about why is the middle class taking care of when they've done all of the right things, and then they end up with a spouse with Alzheimer's, even though they did all the long-term care. And that hole is what I'm so concerned about.
To the witnesses?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tremba, we are working on a partnership program that does just what you're talking about, and I'd be happy to talk to you about it later.
Yeah, I'd really like that.
Okay.
Yeah. Mr. Johnson, do you want to testify? You're in favor? Okay. Thank you.
Representative Chair, I'd also add we have some people from the long-term care imperative who I don't think we need to hear testimony at this point, but who are in support of this.
Great. Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just wondered, I thought the motion was to send this to taxes, and I just wondered, doesn't this need to go to commerce as well, or will it go there after taxes? Because this is, I really feel strongly that this should be looked at by the Commerce Committee, because, frankly, I have some questions about, you know, how the having this credit, the impact it might have on insurance rates, and how, you know, I have a bunch of questions I don't want to ask here because they really don't belong here, but I think they belong in the Commerce Committee.
Well, maybe the witnesses have just briefly, I mean, is this going to affect rates or the availability of the insurance that's already, I mean, it's not going to affect the product.
No.
Per se, it's going to just allow people to buy the product.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think it will affect rates at all, but it will make it more attractive and more economically feasible for more people to purchase the product.
I mean, it's up to you, Representative Gall.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Liebling, if anything, this, you know, if you buy into the idea of insurance pooling, you get more people in the pool, it tends to have a moderating effect on rates. It might actually have an improving factor on it. But again, this is a tax credit. It's not buying down the actual cost of the insurance that you'd have that kind of effect on the industry, so to speak, or the product. It's allowing people to be able to purchase the product as it is, priced as it is off the shelf.
Any other thoughts, Representative Tremba?
Mr. Chair, I've also, and you may have, I know that some states are actually working on, and I don't know if they've passed it, where they, it's a long-term care policy, and if you die and it hasn't been used, it turns into a life insurance piece. So I would hope we can
Mr. Chairman,
talk about
Representative
that
Tremba, there are policies that have a cash value buildup. They're a little more expensive, but they do have that feature.
Representative Liebling?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I just, you know, having people who represent the insurance industry tell me that it isn't going to affect any of these things doesn't really give me the comfort factor that I need. And I was on Commerce in the last biennium, and I seem to remember that we heard some bills relating to these topics. And I guess I would just ask the Chair to consider that because it just strikes me that there might be some issues, and if there aren't, that's fine. But I guess the question is, you know, whether there are.
Sure. Representative Abler,
advice.
Yes.
If you send it to, it's getting great snowy out there. If you send it to taxes, you can talk to the Commerce Chair and see if he wants it, and that'll move it along and solve the blizzard.
Okay. Zach, are you comfortable with that, Representative Lindley? I will talk to Representative Atkins about that. Representative Norton.
Chair Thiessen, members, and I don't want to belabor this, but it's kind of a new area for me, and so I just had a couple questions. One is, do we offer this advantage for people with their health care policies in general? Tax
no.
credits? And if this is good for long-term care, why wouldn't this be, or maybe it would be good for people with their health care premiums as well? Just a question.
Another bill, maybe. Representative Gottwell.
Mr.
No,
Chair,
I mean, that's legit, a good question. But.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, I'll look forward to that bill. This one really deals with the long-term care piece, and I acknowledge that's an issue for other health care coverage as well, but this bill obviously deals with the long-term care piece.
Yeah, can I answer her question?
Representative Abler.
The reason that you would do it for this and not something else is you're trying to drive people to get this. If people will buy this policy, the savings to the state in the long run will be mammoth, and the quality of care will be greatly improved.
Representative Abel, I totally hear what you're saying, but one of the things we deal with is at this table since I've come here is that not everybody that can get insurance does, and if there was an incentive for everybody to buy their own insurance, perhaps that might work there too, which is where it's coming from.
You know, and I think there'll probably be some discussion of that as we get to
okay.
health care reform stuff.
Can I ask
there's those
a
proposals
couple
out there.
Questions?
Yes.
Okay, Chelsea. And anyone that knows the answer can answer for me. What is a typical long-term care premium?
Ms. LeClaire.
And I know there's a variety, but if
the average is $1,300 annually.
And so this substantial increase from $100 maximum to $1,000 is pretty much covering a person's insurance. So the state is, for the most part, perhaps paying for someone's long-term care policy.
Chairman?
I'm trying to clarify.
It's 25%. So at that $1,300 range, the actual credit would be around $330.
Okay. Thank you. That's one of the things I was getting at. And then the other piece was that there is a... By giving another tax credit, and maybe this is why it goes to taxes, there will be effects on state and federal taxes as well.
That's what's going to
And that's why it's going
It'll
to
be a cost to the state, certainly.
And then so Tina's, I'm sorry, Representative Liebling's issue, was, in addition, there may be commerce issues as well. So that's what
correct.
Okay.
Exactly.
Thank you for the help with that.
Representative Schumper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If the average premium is $1,300, what's the range of premiums?
Ms. LeClaire.
We will see policies to $4,000 or $5,000. They can be higher than that.
On
the low end, I would say if somebody buys it when they're younger in their 40s, perhaps $800-$900.
So. Further questions, members? Okay. Then Representative Gottwald will renew his motion that House File 309 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Taxes. All in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Is that... Do the pages, is the Child Care Committee still going to meet today, do we know? Okay, then we're going to have to adjourn at this point, and we'll pick up the last bill, I apologize, next week. So thank you, members, for your endurance today. Have a good day, and good luck getting home. We did already. We're adjourned.